Heads up. Welcome to Death Panel, where according to Sarah Palin, Barack Obama will decide whether or not to kill her parents and Down syndrome baby.
Please don't kill my parents and Down syndrome baby.
This panel sentences them to death.
This death panel is pure evil.
Evil.
Evil. Oh, it's just a horrible dream. Thank God we have a for-profit health insurance industry that never ever denies health care to people. Am I right?
We're people gonna rise up, take what's there. It's finally the table are starting to turn.
That was Look Back at Last Week in History, and you're about to hear This Week in Radical History for the week starting August 17th.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This Week in Radical History is produced from the Mobile Fortress of Glee Glee Studios. Special thanks this week to the Radio Roots crew from WBAI in New York City for some audio that I'm borrowing for this week's show, an example of which you're about to hear right now. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, August 17th in 1893, the controversial white American actress and playwright Mae West was born in Queens, New York. Mae West began her successful onstage career at a young age. She later wrote and starred in her first Broadway play entitled Sex, which riled up city officials and landed Mae West in jail for public obscenity. Her next play, The Drag, was about gay transgendered men and was completely banned from Broadway. Even in Hollywood, Mae West continued to shock the world with her risque and sexual material, and her work was constantly being censored. During her career, West performed two radio sketches that were apparently outrageous enough to panic the FCC and get her banned from the NBC network.
You go, girl.
Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you never let the past slip away.
Debunking the myth that America was founded on religious freedoms, on August 18th, 1634, Arbane Grandier is burned at the stake for being a witch. Also on August 18, 1941, in a letter to President Roosevelt, Representative John Dingell suggests incarceration of 10,000 Hawaiian Japanese Americans as hostages to ensure, quote, good behavior on the part of Japan, unquote. Also on August 18, 1977, South Africa, Steve Binko, a leading student apartheid resistor, was arrested in Port Elizabeth, later while in custody murdered. To quote Steve Binko, the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. Lastly, for August 18, 1996, the prison population rises to nearly 1.6 million inmates, double the number of a decade ago, the Justice Department said. This week in Radical History for August 19, 1503, thou shalt not kill. Well, tell that to Pope Alexander VI, who dies accidentally of poison intended for his guests. Also on this date in 1692 in the New World, five people, including the town's former minister, hung in Salem for witchcraft. There is a long list of religious persecution in New World, like the followers of Thomas Morton, who set up a trading colony upstate from the Puritans' Plymouth colony. This colony was much more successful than the Puritans' colony, for they actually treated the area natives as friends rather than hated heathens. Morton's colony had a live-and-let-live attitude, which included a monthly dancing around the Maypole Dance celebration. The Puritans could have none of that, and struck down Morton's colony, destroying it by force. The long, long line of religious persecution in New World not only included Morton's colony and supposed witches, but anyone not of the Puritans' faith like Quakers who were regularly forced out of the New World colonies. Yep, America's founded on religious freedom. True, as long as that religious is pious enough. Otherwise, they're destroyed by the evangelical zealots. Also on August 19, 1911, Mexican troops battle for the anarchist Zapatista-controlled cities. Also on that date in 1953 in Iran, troops overthrow liberal-leaning premier and put the pro-Western dictator in power in a coup directed by the CIA, all to protect the American interests. Also on that date in 1958, NAACP Youth Council begins sit-in at desegregated lunch counters in Oklahoma. Also on that date in 1971, H.R. Haldeman, President Nixon's hatchet man, orders an FBI investigation of CIA news correspondent Danielle Shore, who had analyzed the president's speech, quote, unfavorably, unquote. Lastly, on August 19, 1989, South Africa Nobel Peace Prize winner Bishop Desmond Tutu are among hundreds of black demonstrators who are whipped and sandblasted by helicopters as they attempt to picnic on the white-only beaches near Cape Town. This week in Radical History for August 20th, 150 years plus before the official founding of America, on this date in 1619, the first group of 20 African slaves land in Jamestown, Virginia.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Maria Tumbawala. On this day, August 20th, in 1831, Nat Turner led a huge slave uprising in Southampton County, Virginia. The revolt began with only 6 followers, but eventually gained the support of approximately 60 slaves, who traveled from house to house murdering white slave owners and freeing slaves. 57 whites were killed. Although Nat Turner managed to escape the pursuing militia for 6 weeks, he was eventually arrested and brutally executed. In the months that followed, 55 black people suspected of being involved in Nat Turner's rebellion were executed and hundreds were beaten, tortured, and slaughtered by angry white mobs. While controversial, Nat Turner is viewed by many as a heroic symbol of black resistance to oppression. A little too militant for American Black History Month. Yeah, I said it.
Also on August 20th, 1886, sentences are handed down against the Haymarket trial defendants, found guilty despite obvious innocence. 7 anarchists are condemned to death. The hangings of the 7 innocent men will take place on November 11, 1887. Lastly, for August 20, 1998, U.S. cruise missiles pound targets in Sudan and Afghanistan and accidentally in Pakistan, targeting pharmaceutical industry factories, maker of anti-malaria and veterinarian drugs. Cruise missiles precisely target and destroy the factories. Quote, there is no sanctuary for terrorists and no limit to the resolve to defend American citizens and our interests, or our ideals of democracy and laws, unquote, says Clinton's U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen. Still later, the U.S. finally confessed that it erred in claiming that the plant was manufacturing storing nerve gas or any link to Osama bin Laden, as was previously stated. Oops, my bad.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, August 21st, in 1971, Black Panther member and political prisoner George Jackson was shot dead by prison guards while attempting to escape from San Quentin Prison. At the time he was killed, Jackson was incarcerated for the murder of a white prison guard. The killing of the guard had been in retaliation for the earlier murder of 3 black activists in a nearby prison, in which case the guard was acquitted and the murders ruled justifiable homicide. Jackson had become politicized the first time he was locked up at the age of 18, and he quickly earned a reputation as a black revolutionary. There are even some speculations that the FBI was involved in the assassination of George Jackson as part of their COINTELPRO mission to eliminate all radical black social resistance. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History for August 22nd, I only got a couple items. 1692, 8 more persons hung in Salem, Massachusetts, charged with witchcraft. Also on August 22nd, 1968, Remy Davis tells Chicago city officials it would be, quote, suicide, unquote, not to allow demonstrators during the Democratic National Convention to sleep in city parks. Tomorrow, Officer Friendly posts 11 p.m. curfew signs in park trees at Lincoln and Grand Parks. The whole world will be watching the Chicago police beating and gassing everyone and everybody they can get their hands on. Lastly, for August 22, 1972, police arrest 891 over 2 days as thousands of anti-war protesters disrupt the Miami Beach Convention of the Republican Party. People, the time's
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Maria Tumbawala. On this day, August 22nd, in 1989, black activist Huey P. Newton was shot dead while walking along a street in Oakland, California. Newton had become involved with campus activism while attending Oakland City College years earlier. After connecting with Bobby Seale, the two organized the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense in 1966. The organization's radical view against the oppressive social structure of the American government and its confrontation of Oakland's racist police force gained them a quick reputation with the FBI. After his release from a short stint in prison, Newton renounced political violence and forced his activism on beneficial community outreach programs. Newton was allegedly murdered by a drug dealer, and the media used this idea to rip apart Newton's reputation and devalidate him as a positive community leader. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History for August 23rd, 1500 New World, Christopher Columbus, accused of mistreatment of natives in Haiti, is arrested and sent back to Spain in chains. Could have threw him overboard and saved us a lot of trouble. Also on August 23rd, 1911, Ishi, last member of a Stone Age tribe in America, is discovered in California. For a great book about Ishi coming out of the wilderness into the white world, see the book Ishi of Two Worlds. Also on August 23, 1917, riots occur in Houston, Texas, when the 24th Infantry seeks revenge to the city's white police after a brutal beating of two black regimental soldiers. After 2 hours of violence, 15 whites, including four policemen, are killed and 18 more are injured. Four soldiers died. 118 soldiers are charged in connection with the riots, and 19 are executed, most in almost total secrecy, in one of the most infamous court-martials ever involving African-Americans. More short items for August 23rd, 1946. Three white men are fined $10 in Collins, Mississippi, for the attempted rape of three black women at gunpoint. And justice for all. Also on that date in 1962, always with a hard-on for Castro, JFK administration approves a massive covert sabotage effort against Cuba. Lastly, for August 23rd, 1996, today the net worth of the world's 358 richest people equal the combined income of the poorest 45% of the world's population. That's 2.3 billion people. Once again, way back in 1996, and it's gotten worse since then, 358 people have as much wealth as 2.3 billion people.
Everybody has to pay taxes. Even businessmen that rob and steal and cheat from people every day, even they have to pay taxes.
You have been listening to This Week in Radical History. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Calendar Organizer, and more radical historical info came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. Speaking of inspiration, some down peeps that produced Anarchy Now are also doing a live weekly anarchist ditty. Check out Bottom Up Radio Network or BURN each and every Sunday night starting at 8 p.m. Central Time Zone. And the place you can tune into this anarcho-radical perspective is blogtalkradio.com/rabble. Again, Sundays, 8 p.m. at blogtalkradio.com/RABBLE. Got the bolt. We leave you musically this week with Holy, 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 but this last reminder that I never really leave you, for I'm forever yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
The world is until our memories
some anarchist affiliation that have been causing problems of breaking windows, rioting throughout the town.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next. This Week in Palestine.
غفلة تمتطي فوزا قزح طفلة تمتطي فوزا قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. This morning, the Palestinian voice we feature is that of Columbia University Professor Rashid Khalidi, delivering a paper at SOAS University of London in the spring of 2016 that explores the context of the Zionist colonization of Palestine going back to the British Mandate. Here is Professor Rashid Khalidi at London University.
Thank you, Gilbert. It's a pleasure to be in London again. It's a pleasure to be in this lecture hall again. I remember now that the last time I spoke at SOAS was in this lecture hall. It's a particular pleasure to be at SOAS, where one of my daughters spent a rewarding year working on her MA. I want to thank Gilbert and his colleagues at the Center and at the Middle East Institute for their kind invitation to deliver the Center's annual lecture. Presumably next year you'll be spared another Khalidi giving a lecture, hopefully. It's an honor and a privilege to do so. My focus this evening will, of course, be on Palestine. My title is The 100 Years War in Palestine. But you will notice that some of what I have to say will deal with Palestine in the mind of America and, to a lesser extent, Palestine in the imagination of Europe. I'll be covering large stretches of history, so afterwards, when we have time for questions, if there are things that I've unfortunately had to skip, you will have a chance to ask about that. Let me begin by saying that most of what most Americans think they know about Palestine is wrong. That shouldn't be a surprise. Many of the images that Americans have of Palestine are derived from the Bible. This worthy document was set down millennia ago, and large parts of it have only a tenuous relation, if any relation at all, to historically provable fact. Even worse, some of their images of Palestine come from fictional works, like Leon Uris's multi-million selling novel, Exodus, or the Academy Award-winning Paul Newman film of the same name. If you ask an audience of Americans over the age of 40 or 50, how many of you have read the book or seen the movie, a majority will raise their hands. One of the most influential books, as far as Palestine is concerned, in terms of the American imagination. If they don't come from those sources, they come from other defamatory sources, like Joan Peters' best-selling book, From Time Immemorial, or from highly biased sources like the American mainstream media. In addition, the focus or the referent, the real thing that these things are about in most cases, is actually not Palestine. It's Israel or Jewish history, rather than Palestine or Palestinian history. A typical example of such work that's had an impact in the present day would be Ari Shavit's book, My Promised Land. This is a best-selling book. It had a huge, resounding success in the United States. It's written from a very personal angle. It's very well written. But it's a highly apologetic book written from an Israeli perspective, even though it purports to correct the historical record by chronicling some Israeli maltreatment of the Palestinians. So I would say, in fact, that it's an understatement to say that most existing portrayals of Palestine in the American general culture, whether literary, whether scholarly, or visual, do not reflect a Palestinian perspective. That's an understatement. One could be even more categorical. The Palestinians have, in fact, mainly been defined in the American public mind and in the West generally, though this is less true in this country and in Europe, by those who wish them ill, if they recognize their existence at all. Indeed, it's an article of faith for many opponents of the Palestinians that they do not even exist. This has been repeated again and again by leading American politicians, candidates for president and others, senators, congressmen. And this canard is the central theme of Joan Peters' book, which when it was published got plaudits from the good and the great, luminaries such as Elie Wiesel, Saul Bellow, Barbara Tuchman, Bernard Lewis, Alan Dershowitz, the good and the great in the American public pantheon. Although it was utterly discredited by every reputable scholar who ever reviewed it, without exception, everywhere, this book is still in print. If you Google it on Amazon, you'll see that it's selling better than most of my books or Gilbert's books or books by many of my colleagues and friends in this audience. No insult to any of us. And this 30 years after it was first published. Many more books like Peter's from time immemorial have appeared since then. And this is what you might call denialist literature. It argues that there is no such subject as the Palestinians. The center that we established at Columbia, the center that has been established here at SOAS, shouldn't exist. It's a non-topic, no such thing. In a sense, what I'm arguing is that the Palestinians have been elided from the historical record, or at least there has been an attempt to elide them from the historical record. In the words of Edward Said, they have been denied the permission to narrate. They cannot tell their own story, in other words. Even when they're allowed to appear on stage, in public forums, or in the media, they have to have a minder. That means, in the American context, their appearance is carefully balanced with the opposing point of view. In other words, you can't say something about the Palestinians without having someone to say, well, this, of course, is not true from another perspective. Such balance, I would note, is never required in the United States when an Israeli, or rarely required in the United States when an Israeli perspective is put forward. Now, what I want to do this evening is to turn away from all of these distorted ways in which the history of Palestine is usually depicted, whether that's from an Israeli point of view, or whether that's from a falsely balanced perspective, or whether it's between a supposed conflict between two equal parties. I'm going to push all of those approaches, which are the approaches that are generally followed by most interpretations, aside. In their stead, in place of those kinds of approaches, I would like to put forward an entirely different perspective in order to illuminate the history of the past century in Palestine as the Palestinians have experienced it, and I would argue as most people in the formerly colonized world also see it, and that's most people in the world. I hope thereby to provide a richer understanding of the real conflict over that land today. Now, from this perspective, the one that I want to use this evening, the period since the Balfour Declaration of November 29, 1917, has amounted to what, has witnessed, I should say, what amounts to 100 years of war against the Palestinians. Like many other long-lasting wars, this one has had long periods of apparent calm, interspersed with paroxysms of violence. However, this war had a unique nature. It was formally sanctioned and authorized by the greatest powers of the day at different times over the past century. Indeed, this war could not have taken place without them, but it was mainly waged by others. I'm going to repeat that sentence. This war was formally sanctioned and authorized by the greatest powers of the day at different times over the past century. Indeed, this war could not have taken place without them, but it was mainly waged by others. An important feature of this long war, one which has been much distorted has been the Palestinians' continuing resistance against heavy odds to what amounts to one of the last ongoing attempts at colonial subjugation in the modern world. Taking this approach is not in any way to chronicle the history of the Palestinians as one of their victimization. Indeed, it gives them full agency as people resisting a long campaign to remove them from their land and from history. Nor is it to whitewash the many grievous mistakes of Palestinian leaders. As I wrote in The Iron Cage, much of the history of the Palestinian people must be understood in terms of the very bad choices made by their leaders at different times, albeit often in the most difficult of circumstances. What the people of Palestine experienced as a continuous war against them since 1917 is still underway today. It thereby constitutes a global anomaly. All the other recent wars to uproot colonial settler regimes in the second half of the 20th century, whether this was in Algeria or southern Africa or elsewhere, finally ended with the defeat of these regimes. This has not happened in Palestine. Instead, in Palestine, Israel has thus far been highly successful in forcibly establishing itself both as a colonial reality and as a powerful nation-state in a post-colonial age. It has done this while always assuming a false posture of self-defense, which I'm sure will be familiar to most of you. The great historian and theoretician of colonialism, Patrick Wolfe, who sadly just passed away, wrote the following. I'm quoting Patrick Wolfe. Settler colonies were, in brackets are, premised on the elimination of the native societies. The split tensing, were, are, the split tensing reflects a determinate feature of settler colonization. The colonizers come to stay. Invasion is a structure, not an event. He's thinking, of course, of Australia. You could say the same thing about New Zealand. You could say the same thing about Canada or the United States. But think of those words in regard to Palestine. In Palestine, both that structure and the war that resulted from it are still ongoing today after 100 years. It is a war that seems endless to the Palestinians themselves. Now, there have been repeated authoritative international pronouncements that amounted to declarations of war by the great powers that were sponsors of this long colonial campaign against the Palestinians. The first of these was issued in November of 1917, November 2nd, to be exact, on behalf of the British Cabinet by Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour, the Balfour Declaration. British troops were then in the process of conquering Palestine. They occupied Jerusalem a couple of weeks afterwards, on December 9th of 1917. The Balfour Declaration and the League of Nations mandate that was later granted to Britain on the basis of this declaration, and which repeated the terms of the declaration in the preamble to the mandate verbatim, this declaration and this mandate arrogated national rights in Palestine exclusively to Jews, who were at that time, of course, a tiny minority of the population. It thereby denied the national existence and political rights of the vast Arab majority of Palestine's people. So the Balfour Declaration and the mandate said that there is one people in Palestine. There's one group with national rights. Neither the declaration nor the mandate ever named this population, which had lived in its own country for generations. So the word Arab or Palestinian doesn't occur in the Balfour Declaration. It doesn't occur in the mandate for Palestine. The Balfour Declaration has been considered historically in terms of various paradigms, mainly in terms of Zionist or British considerations, and there has been good work on both of these sides of it. However, it was in fact a quintessentially colonial proclamation by the greatest power of its day of that power's intent to replace an indigenous people with another people whom it proposed to bring into existence on that indigenous people's territory. For two decades, without fail, actually for 22 years, without fail, Britain carried out to the letter the terms of the Balfour Declaration and of the League of Nations mandate. that defined and regulated British rule over Palestine while embodying and amplifying the terms of the Balfour Declaration. In keeping with the mandate, Britain supported Zionist immigration and land purchase and granted self-governing institutions and international diplomatic status to the Jewish minority. A para-state was created under the mandate by the terms of the mandate, while self-government and diplomatic status were refused to the Arab majority. Provoked by Britain's denial of their rights and indeed of their very existence as a people, the Palestinians belatedly rebelled in 1936 to 1939. They briefly liberated some towns and parts of the countryside, but the British Empire responded ruthlessly, employing over 100,000 troops and extensive air power to crush this uprising. In the process, the British killed, wounded, deported, or imprisoned 10% of the adult male population of Palestine. They also confiscated large quantities of weapons. They exiled or jailed most leaders, and executed a very large number of them. This was the delayed military implementation of Britain's original 1917 declaration of war on the Palestinian people. I have stressed in what I've said so far the role of Britain. And it's important that you keep your mind on that, because I'm going to follow up with a similar stress on other powers. Now, as any historian can tell you, the same dates, the same events, the same individuals can have a completely different valence for different people. There are battles that mean one thing to one group and something else to another group. Thus, for Israelis, Arthur James Balfour is a hero. There are streets named for him in Israeli cities. There's a town named for him, in fact. And the promulgation of the Balfour Declaration in 1917 is an occasion for celebration in Israel. Balfour is obviously not a hero to the Palestinians. Why this was so can be understood from a close textual analysis of a number of key documents from this era, starting from the Balfour Declaration, which defined British policy really for the entirety of the mandate period. This declaration, as I've noted, says that there's only one people with national rights in Palestine, the Jewish people. The Palestinians are, as I've said, described not by name or even as Arabs, but only as, quote, existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. So 94% of the population never named, are not given national rights, and are described only as the existing non-Jewish population. This vast majority of Palestine's population is only guaranteed civil and religious rights. They are not guaranteed political rights, and they are not guaranteed national rights. So there's one community with national rights, and the right to a para-state and other legal protections. Another community is simply given civil and religious rights. So that's the first document, which I've already talked about. Second, I've already briefly talked about, which I haven't talked about, is Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations. This was issued in June 1919, and it described the Arab peoples of the regions of the former Ottoman Empire as independent nations. You would think, well, that means Palestine. It didn't mean Palestine. This Article of the Covenant, Article 22, which supposedly governed the entire mandate system, was consistently interpreted, both by Britain and by the League of Nations, to exclude Palestine. This did not apply to Palestine in the view of the British. In other words, Article 22, as far as Balfour and his colleagues were concerned, guaranteed self-determination to all Arab peoples who had formerly been part of the Ottoman Empire, but not to the Palestinians. Because in Palestine, self-determination was promised to the Jewish people. So that's the second document. There's a third, which, if you examine it carefully, yields some interesting things. This is a confidential memo that Balfour wrote to his colleagues in the cabinet in August 1919, and it wasn't published for decades. It was first published, in fact, in the 1950s. And in it, Balfour was more candid than he ever was in public. He said, and I'm quoting from this memo, "Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad, is rooted in age-long traditions, in present needs, in future hopes of far greater import than the desires," you almost want to hear the mere desires, but he didn't say mere, "than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now, just for the moment, inhabit that land, that ancient land. Balfour went on to say, I quote again, in Palestine, and this follows from what he just said, in Palestine, we do not propose even to go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country. That's the third document. The last one is the 1922 League of Nations mandate for Palestine. This reiterated the Balfour Declaration verbatim, as I've said, amplified the terms of the declaration, and it produced an operational plan for effectively eliminating an existing people and replacing it with another. If you read the mandate, it has 11 or 12 articles solely devoted to the establishment of a Jewish national home. The rest have to do with things like taxation. Nothing, in fact, deals directly with the political or national aspirations of the majority there. In fact, those aspirations are to be denied. That's what this document means. It's clear from all of these documents that Palestinians and their rights simply had no importance for British decision makers, or for that matter, for decision makers in the League of Nations. Taken together and read closely, these statements of policy, whether by Britain or the League of Nations, in effect constituted an international justification for politicide, meaning the destruction of the emerging Palestinian polity, to use a term that was coined by the late Israeli sociologist Baruch Kimmerling. This politicide was implemented both by omission — Palestinians are never mentioned in any of the documents that governed their collectivity right up to 1948, and by commission, as three of these documents explicitly declare that Palestine is to be transformed into a Jewish national home. In spite of the vague and ambiguous nature of this term, Jewish national home, British leaders understood clearly that it meant creating an ultimate Jewish majority in Palestine and thereby turning it into a Jewish state. This is not in the terms of the mandate. It's not in the Balfour Declaration. It's not even in Balfour's confidential memos. But this is precisely what Lloyd George, Winston Churchill, and Arthur Balfour later privately told Chaim Weizmann, who of course was the leader of the Zionist movement, first president of Israel, at a dinner meeting in Balfour's house in 1929, which is recorded in the Weizmann papers. They told him, this is what we mean. We mean a Jewish majority. We mean a Jewish state. That's what we mean, Jewish national home, that's what we understand this term to mean. Three of these documents, in other words, constitute a slightly watered down and more palatable version of the core Zionist objective of transforming Palestine into a Jewish state from an Arab country. Now, I've mentioned that the military campaign which enforced these declarations of policy was prosecuted by the might of the British Armed Forces, especially during the period 1936-39, in response to the resistance of the Palestinians to British rule and to the colonial project that Britain supported. One of the clearest expressions that I've ever found of what was at stake was issued by Vladimir Jabotinsky in the 20s. Jabotinsky, as you may know, was the founder of the militant revisionist wing of the Zionist movement, out of which grew the ideological current that since 1977 has dominated Israeli politics with few interruptions. The current prime minister's father was Jabotinsky's private secretary. Jabotinsky was explicit in stressing the necessity of what he called, quote, an iron wall of British bayonets for the success of Zionism. He frankly recognized that, quote, in the history of colonization — this is Jabotinsky speaking — in the history of colonization in other countries, every native population, civilized or not, regards its lands as its national home. This is equally true of the Arabs, end of quote. Note Jabotinsky's frank use of the terms colonization to describe Zionist activity and the native population to describe the Palestinians. We don't get the same frankness after Jabotinsky in pronouncements by leaders of the Zionist movement. Jabotinsky concluded that overcoming the natural resistance of this population to their subjugation and displacement required, quote, an iron wall, which is to say, a strong power in Palestine that is not amenable to any Arab pressure. Of course, he was right. He meant at that stage the British. At later stages, that strong power was the United States, and at another stage, the United States and the Soviet Union. For two decades, it was Britain that provided this iron wall, without which Jabotinsky freely admitted that Zionist colonization could not have been successfully pursued. Now, that they have been the targets of a long war is central to Palestinians' own understanding of the conflict. Older people inside Palestine, in the refugee camps, and in the larger diaspora, Palestinian diaspora, talk of the British or the Israelis or the Americans in almost the same breath, as if they're different faces of the same foe. In other words, they see things more clearly than a lot of scholars, just ordinary folks in the camps or elsewhere. Palestinians thus see their history since 1917 as involving their people being targets of this unending war to which they have offered continued resistance. For them, this history blends seamlessly into the present and, unfortunately, probably into the future. In their historical experience, the unceasing colonization of their country, which they see taking place before them every day in the West Bank or in Jerusalem and inside Israel, this unceasing colonization and the constant resort to violence that is required for its maintenance is, to reprise the words of Patrick Wolfe, a structure, not an event. Now, let me move in time, leaping forward. The superpowers of the post-World War II era, the United States and the Soviet Union, were responsible for two further authoritative international pronouncements endorsing the Zionist project and its transformation into the State of Israel that I am arguing amounted to declarations of war on the Palestinians. These were once again issued via the ostensibly neutral medium of an international organization similar to the League of Nations. This time, it was the United Nations. This new world body gave the patina of legal sanction to further violations of the inalienable national rights of the indigenous Arab population of Palestine. By this point, as you know, most of you, Britain had been weakened by the massive effort it had made in World War II and by the loss of India, while in Palestine it was being battered by attacks by the attacks of Zionist terrorists, notably the Irgun and the Stern Gang, which later on gave leadership to Israel in the form of Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, prime ministers of Israel. In consequence of this, Great Britain was forced to abandon Palestine, throwing it into the lap of the United Nations, where the two new superpowers had predominant influence. The first of these two new declarations of war on the Palestinians came on November 29, 1947, via UN General Assembly Resolution 181 for the partition of Palestine. This resolution was engineered entirely by the United States and the Soviet Union, which ensured a majority vote by their compliant allies and satellites. Resolution 181 handed over most of a majority Arab country to its Jewish minority without the consent of that majority. It thereby violated the principle of self-determination that had been enshrined in the UN Charter only 2 years earlier. This led in turn to the War of 1947-49, which devastated Palestinian society and caused the expulsion of more than half of that country's Arab population from their homes. As we all know, they were never allowed to return. Partition allocated nearly 55% of the territory of Mandatory Palestine to a Jewish state, which represented a realization of the Zionist dream of sovereignty and statehood in Palestine. The Arabs, over two-thirds of the population, were supposed to have a so-called Arab state divided into three segments, which together comprised later less than 45% of the entire country, which the Palestinians naturally saw as their own. For these contrasting reasons, the resolution was accepted by the leading elements in the Zionist movement and was rejected by most Palestinians and by all the Arab states with the sole exception of Jordan. Palestinian and Arab disunity then contributed to the crushing defeat suffered first by the Palestinians themselves in the months leading up to the British evacuation of May 15, 1948, and subsequently to the resounding defeat of the four Arab armies, the armies of Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Iraq, that entered Palestine after the British withdrawal. long before the British left, long before May 15th, as many as 300,000 Palestinians had already been driven from their homes. In other words, the exodus began long before the State of Israel was actually established and long before the mandate actually technically ended. Some left because of things like unceasing mortar bombardments of urban areas. Others fled as news spread of massacres like Deir Yassin in April 1948. The city of Jaffa was overrun by Arab forces, by Zionist forces, and was emptied by most of its Arab population of about 60,000 in late April 1948. Those who were driven out before the mandate ended and before the State of Israel was formally established included most of the Arab residents of two of the three cities with the largest Arab populations, that is to say Jaffa, Haifa, and much of the Arab population of West Jerusalem. Palestinian society was thus effectively decapitated. Most of its urban population forced to flee before May 15, 1948. After that date, after the establishment of Israel, in the wake of further massacres and the defeat of the Arab armies, another 400,000 or so Palestinians were expelled. Several more cities were ethnically cleansed, as were 400 villages, and 78% of Palestine was forcibly transformed into the new State of Israel, which expanded from the partition boundaries. The destruction of most of their society has since been known by the Palestinians as a Nakba, the disaster. Now, I'm arguing here that the partition resolution was a reiteration and updating by new powers of the 1917 declaration of war on the Palestinians, obviously in a different form and obviously with different sponsors. After World War II, colonialism had become a bad word. You didn't hear reference to colonization or Zionist colonization, which people had no embarrassment in talking about before World War II. National liberation was in the air, and the Zionist project was repackaged as self-determination for the national movement of a people that had been cruelly oppressed in Europe. This was an incontrovertible argument in the immediate aftermath of the revelation of the horrors of the Holocaust. This time, however, the patrons of Zionism were the U.S. and USSR rather than Britain, and once again, there was international cover for this action, UN cover rather than League of Nations cover. The only true concern of the superpowers that engineered the partition resolution was to complete Herzl's colonial project and create the State of Israel. Even though the creation of an Arab state is mentioned in this resolution, everything beyond the establishment of Israel was window dressing for them. The quick strangulation of the Arab state in its cradle through the well-documented collusion of Israel, Jordan, and Britain was met with indifference by the powers that had supposedly mandated the creation of an Arab state. They didn't care about that. That's not what they were interested in. They were interested in the Jewish state mentioned in the partition resolution. Now, in this phase, the actual acts of war against the Palestinians were carried out before May 15th by Zionist militias and after that date by the newly established Army of the State of Israel, with arms supplied mainly by the two superpowers. This is important. This marked a major shift from the previous phase when most warfare against the Palestinians had been carried out by the British. So that's the first of these two new declarations of war. The other superpower mandated pronouncement amounting to a declaration of war on the Palestinians was UN Security Council Resolution 242 of November 1967, following the June War of that year. This resolution was supposedly meant to produce peace between the Arab states and Israel in return for evacuation of territory that Israel had occupied during the war. As some of you may have noticed, to this day that resolution has not actually produced peace, but that's what it was supposed to do. Instead, as far as the Palestinians were concerned, 242 consecrated the results of the 1948 war, both in terms of Israel's expulsion of Palestinians and its territorial aggrandizement up to 1949. The resolution never mentioned any of the basic political issues raised by the 48 war or that had been earlier mandated by UN resolutions, such as refugee return and compensation, or Israel giving up the gains of the 1948 war and returning to the lines laid down by the partition plan. Instead, 242 referred only to a just settlement of the refugee problem. There was no specification of what this vague proviso meant, nor did it have any explicit political content. Resolution 242 thereby helped to further efface the Palestinians from their own country and from history. The green light which U.S. President Lyndon Johnson gave to Israel for its attack of 1967 represented a turning point from the much more limited levels of U.S. support that had previously been offered to Israel by earlier American presidents. Indeed, between 1948 and 67, Israel's main great power patrons were France and Great Britain, and it was mainly with French and British arms that Israel fought the 56 and 67 wars. Thereafter, the June 67 war marked the beginning of a full-scale U.S.-Israeli alliance, which was forged in the circumstances of the Cold War, when Israel first came to be seen as a faithful ally against the Soviet Union's Arab proxies. As we all know, this alliance is still in existence a quarter of a century after the end of the Cold War. Now, as I've suggested, 242, in fact, represented yet another declaration of war on the Palestinians, this time by the superpowers and their allies. Like the Balfour Declaration, 242, which has become the universally accepted basis for a resolution of the entire conflict, does not even mention the Palestinians as a people or as a party to the conflict. This is true, although they have always represented the core of the problem in Palestine, going back to their displacement in 1948 in order to create a Jewish majority state in a country with a large Arab majority. By shunting the Palestinians aside with the wording a just settlement of the refugee problem, 242 treats the entire issue as one between the Arab states and Israel. It doesn't have a Palestinian component, 242. Like the Balfour Declaration, it completely ignores the ongoing colonial process in Palestine, in effect sanctifying it, a process that was exacerbated by Israel's occupation of the remaining parts of the country. 242 thus constitutes what I would argue is another great power act of Kimmerling's term politicide. Now, after the crushing defeats of the Palestinians in the 30s and then the 40s, it may have seemed as if the Palestinian people had disappeared. Looking at the Middle East in the 1950s, their traditional leadership under the discredited Mufti of Jerusalem had been shattered and dispersed. More than half of the Palestinian Arab population had become refugees, and most of the country had been absorbed into Israel, with Jordan and Egypt in control of smaller parts. The Palestinians seemed to have no voice, no central address, and no champions. Partisans of the Zionist takeover of Palestine and of the replacement of the country's indigenous inhabitants with a Jewish settler population had long fervently hoped for such an outcome. In 1969, Golda Meir told the Sunday Times of London categorically, there were no such things as Palestinians. Israel's prime minister thereby took the negationism that is characteristic of every colonial project to the highest possible level. For Meir, the Palestinians not only did not exist, they never had existed. Even as she spoke, however, events were proving that the Palestinians were still in existence. For after a hiatus that lasted for a decade after 1948, young middle-class Palestinian professionals inside and outside their homeland resuscitated their shattered national movement on a very different basis than the one that had characterized the elite-dominated Palestinian politics of the period before 1948. The 1967 war gave an enormous boost to these radical new groups, which openly advocated and practiced what they called armed struggle against Israel. People all over the Arab world were galvanized by the reemergence of the Palestinian national movement, represented by the rise of these armed groups like Fatah, the Popular Front, and so forth, which later coalesced into the PFLP. This rebirth of their national movement in a new form constituted another episode of resistance by the Palestinians to the long war against them. It was a reaffirmation that the Palestinians existed in the face of constant denial. This denial was evidenced not only by statements like those of Golda Meir, but by the demolition after 1948 of over 400 Palestinian villages whose populations had been ethnically cleansed. As grave as these Israeli actions, and I'm trying to stress this, as grave as these actions, the destruction of the villages, the refusal of permission for them to their populations to return, as grave as these actions was the considered decision of the United States, of the Soviet Union, of the other great powers, as expressed through Security Council Resolution 242, to ignore the Palestinians entirely, not invited to peace conferences, not mentioned in international resolutions. They don't exist in practice. It was not only, therefore, against their dispossession, but against all of these denials and slights that the newly galvanized Palestinians reacted in the 60s and 70s. They did so by violently asserting their existence with a series of spectacular attacks inside Israel and abroad. The response in the United States and Israel and parts of Europe to these Palestinian attacks was, of course, intensely negative. It stigmatized the Palestinians as terrorists. By this stage, at least in the mind of America, Israel had erased its colonial past and was instead seen in terms of positive images drawn from the kinds of sources I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture. Periodically, or I should say, paradoxically, this period, when the Palestinians were being demonized in some quarters, was also marked by their success in internationalizing their struggle beyond the confines of the Arab world. In other words, at a time when people in the United States were thinking of the Palestinians intensely negatively, in other parts of the world, people began to think of them more positively. The PLO was recognized as sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. It garnered worldwide recognition. Yasser Arafat spoke before the UN General Assembly. The PLO opened missions in over 100 countries and so forth. This was the greatest international victory in Palestinian history, this international recognition, after so many years of non-recognition. However, the main response to the PLO's armed violence and to the organization's growing international profile was a ratcheting up of the war on the Palestinians. Although Israel took the lead in this war, launching attacks on Palestinian bases and refugee camps in Jordan and Lebanon from 1967 onwards, many other actors were also involved. And I want to stress this. Some of these actors were drawn into fighting the Palestinian resistance movement by unceasing Israeli military pressure, whose clear message was that if Arab host countries would not take on the PLO, Israel would continue to devastate their country. One of the first of these demonstration raids was the Israeli attack on Beirut Airport in 1968. It wasn't an attack on Palestinian camps. It wasn't an attack on Palestinians. It was an attack on Middle East Airlines and the Beirut Airport. A crucial early front in this war was in Jordan, where during what the Palestinians called Black September, Jordanian troops in 1970 crushed the PLO in Amman and other cities. Jordan was strongly backed by the United States in this effort. You can read it in Kissinger's memoirs, and you can read in the archival sources that are now available how extensive and how serious this support was. A few months later, in spring of 1971, Jordan completely expelled PLO groups from its territory. A third front in this war on the Palestinians after 1967 was initiated by a series of Israeli attacks on Lebanon and on the Palestinian presence there. This pressure, subtly supported by the United States, eventually produced offensives against Palestinian refugee camps and PLO bases by a variety of actors. The first of these attacks was launched by the Lebanese army in May of 1973, followed by right-wing Lebanese militia groups in April of 1975, and by the Syrian army in the summer of 1976, and concluded with major invasions of Lebanon by the Israeli army in 1978, Operation Litani, and 1982. In all of this, the United States was far more than a mere onlooker. It was a broker. It was a supporter. It was a cheerleader. We have documents on much of this. American policymakers actively supported these new phases of the war on the Palestinians, often with arms and other forms of assistance, but always acting through proxies. No American soldiers were involved. Other powers were also engaged against the Palestinians at different times during this period. For example, the Soviet Union supported the 1976 Syrian offensive against the PLO. The Shah's Iran, Saudi Arabia, France, and Jordan all supplied Lebanese militia groups like the Falange and the Lebanese forces during the Civil War. While the great powers set the international framework for the war on the Palestinians, and there were Jordanian, Lebanese, Syrian, and other Arab combatants in different phases of the war, from 1947 onward, the brunt of the fighting was done first by the Zionist movement and later by the State of Israel. In all of Israel's military operations, without exception, The backing of external powers was as vital to its success as had been the might of Great Britain before World War II to the success of Zionism. In Israel's victory of 1948, for example, the diplomatic support of the United States and the Soviet Union were as indispensable as the weapons both superpowers supplied. Britain and French arms played a similar key role in the 56 and 67 wars. Israel could not have fought or won any of those wars without those weapons. Weapons are not sold simply to make a profit. They are sold as a political token of the outcome that a superpower, a weapons-producing power, wants to see. Similarly, Israel's unbroken string of military victories over both the Arab armies and the Palestinians since 1967 was entirely dependent on the almost unlimited provision of advanced American weapons systems. Let me now talk about the two last phases of this campaign against the Palestinians. One of them took an ostensibly peaceful and democratic form, starting with the Camp David Accords of 1978. I have no time to go into this. I can go into it in questions. The key events in this peaceful phase were the bilateral 1991 to 93 Palestinian-Israeli Madrid negotiations and Washington negotiations, followed by secret negotiations in Oslo and elsewhere. Billed as an attempt to peacefully resolve the conflict, the objective of both Israel and the United States was in fact to manage the conflict while allowing the extension into the indefinite future of key aspects of a status quo of occupation and colonization. That is what Israel aimed to achieve. That is what the United States allowed it to do. That is what happened. Peace was not the outcome, as you may have noticed. In Washington, Oslo, and subsequent talks, the Palestinians, it turns out, were not in fact negotiating with Israel through a neutral American intermediary, but were actually up against two opponents, Israel and its close ally, the United States. The opponents the Palestinians faced included, in fact, not only Israel and its American patron, but also the autocratic Arab Gulf regimes, whose feebleness vis-a-vis their domestic and external threats and their dependence on the United States ensured that they remained pliable and reliable American clients who could be counted on to put pressure on the PLO. I was involved as an advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Washington negotiations, and at one sticky point, Dennis Ross said to us, you know, if you guys don't back down on this, we're going to get our Arab friends in the Gulf to put some pressure on you. He actually said it. This was not a secret. So the Palestinians had a lot of people across the table from them, not just Eliakim Rubinstein and an Israeli delegation. The problems of the Palestinians included as well the incompetence, the lack of legal knowledge, and the ignorance of conditions inside occupied Palestine of the PLO leadership in Tunis, which, in fact, endorsed and was responsible for the 1993 Oslo Accords. These officials accepted terms at Oslo and in subsequent negotiations that had earlier been rejected in Washington by the Palestinian delegation from the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. In fact, West Bank and Gazan leaders proved more realistic than the PLO leadership in Tunis about the Americans and about Israel. In consequence of all of these factors, and most importantly because of American-Israeli collusion and the failures of the PLO leadership, the regime that emerged from the 1993 Oslo Accords had the effect of denying Palestinian self-determination while allowing the expansion of colonial settlement and occupation. The occupation is far more entrenched today than when we went to Madrid in 1991. Settlements have expanded. The proof of this is that we are going to go into the 50th year of that occupation in June of this year. The proof of this is the growth of numbers in the number of Israelis living illegally in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. When we went to Madrid in 1991, there were 200,000 of them. Between East Jerusalem and the West Bank, there are close to 600,000 of them today. The settler population has tripled during the so-called peace process. This peace process, in effect, constituted another phase in the American-Israeli campaign against the Palestinians. Its primary aim, continuing to this day, is to bring the Palestinians to accept their defeat in the long war that has been waged against them since 1917. I could talk about another international declaration of war on the Palestinians over the past decade. And this would have to do with refusal by the United States and the EU to deal with the entirety of the Palestinian national movement, including Hamas. I could explain the reasons for it to you. But the main reason I'm going to skip over is to, in my view at least, is to split and weaken the Palestinian national movement in keeping with a policy, a classic colonial policy of divide and rule, whereby the Palestinians have been physically divided into those in the West Bank, those in Gaza, those inside Israel, those in East Jerusalem, and those outside of Palestine. The actual acts of war in this last phase have been carried out mainly by Israel, but it was fully supported in this by the United States, by the EU, and by several Arab governments, notably the government of Egypt. These included the siege and blockade of the Gaza Strip, periodic massive attacks on Gaza, all of them with the usual horrendously lopsided casualty figures. This suppression of the Palestinians has taken place with the collusion and collaboration of the Ramallah-based Palestinian Authority that was created by the Oslo Accords, and that was mistakenly thought by some Palestinians to be the first step towards an independent state. In fact, it was nothing of the sort. It was always essentially intended by Israel to protect the security of its occupation and colonization enterprise. The PA is a body which has no sovereignty, no jurisdiction, and no authority except that which is allowed it by Israel. Even today, the PA continues its close security cooperation with the Army of Occupation and with the Israeli intelligence services. Now, this is the argument that I've tried to lay out this evening. You can see from what I've tried to put before you that what has been going on in Palestine for a century has been completely mischaracterized. I think this long war on the Palestinians should be seen in comparative perspective as one of the last major colonial conflicts of the modern era, and as the last one devoted to the establishment of a colonial settler state in the non-European world.
That was Columbia University Professor Rashid Khalidi delivering a paper at the University of London in the spring of 2016. And that is our program this morning. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding.
You're listening to episode 680 of Unwelcome Guests. I'm Robin Upton. And this week's title, Unlawful Killing, is the title of a film that I'm going to be adapting. Before we go any further, if you're a radio producer and you're not on the mailing list for those who air the show locally, then you may not have gathered. This is a radio adaptation of a film that has been effectively more or less banned in the UK and the US. Now, I know nothing about the legal issues of running a local radio station, except removing what the FCC terms as indecent language. I have done that on this film. It contains no expletives that, to my knowledge, will arouse the ill will of the FCC, and I'm certainly not intending to offend anybody's sensibilities by my choice of material. Now, I don't know on what basis it's deemed to be acceptable to prevent people from stating their opinions because they contravene other people's deeply held beliefs, but the makers of this film state at one point that they were advised of 87 legal issues concerning the film. Now, these legal issues have hitherto prevented the film being broadcast widely in the UK or the US. Well, it was that ban that originally attracted me to the film, because I thought, well, if it's full of nonsense, then they're not going to mind it being aired. So I thought, what information does this film have that the establishment particularly seeks to hide? As a result, I've been particularly scrupulous as far as checking out the references. And with the one exception that I cite on the show's description page, that's unwelcomeguest.net/680, then pretty much everything I checked out was easily verifiable. People do seem to agree. For example, that there is a handwritten note by Diana to her butler that Prince Charles was planning a road accident to remove her. They do agree that she said the same thing to her lawyer, who made a note of it the following day, that this note, after the accident, was submitted to the police as evidence, and that it was handed up the chain of command, came into the possession of the chief policeman in the UK, the head of the UK Metropolitan Police, that rather than disclose this information, he chose to sit on it for a few years, and in so doing, laying himself open to a charge of concealing evidence. Well, has that person been brought to justice? A courageous French lawyer has actually picked up the case, long after it had been put to bed by the official UK establishment. Gérard Cadeau was trying to get to the bottom of why the Michcon note was kept secret, who ordered this, and whether any criminal charges should result from it. So as recently as 2012, Lord Condon went and gave evidence about why he hadn't disclosed the note. Now, as the name reveals, far from being judged worthy of censure, Lord Condon was judged by the UK establishment to be the sort of material who should be sitting in the House of Lords for the end of his days, making the laws, so was awarded a life peerage. The sort of thing to make me wonder just how many other life peers are sitting in the House of Lords after a similar chain of circumstances. Anyway, the 2011 film was funded by Mohamed Al-Fayed, father of Diana's fiancé, who was killed with her in the same crash. Now, the film has numerous courtroom reconstructions, which are labelled as such. So when you hear a date and a time, then although it's taken from original notes, so I think the quotes are verbatim what was said, the recordings are not. So the establishment, as we touched on before, doesn't seem to want cameras in the courts of justice, as if justice was something that was better served up in secret. I am sitting here at my desk today in October, longing for someone to hug me and encourage me to keep strong and hold my head high. This particular phrase in my life is the most dangerous. My husband is planning an accident in my car. Brake failure and serious head injury, in order to make the path clear for him to marry Tiggy. Camilla is nothing but a decoy, so we are all being used by the man in every sense of the word. I have been battered, bruised, and abused mentally by a system for 15 years now, but I feel no resentment, I carry no hatred. I am weary of the battles, but I will never surrender. I am strong inside, and maybe that is a problem for my enemies. Unlawful Killing, a film by Keith Allen.
In 1997, the death of a princess and her lover rocked the world. 10 years later, it led to the longest, most expensive, and most sensational inquest in British legal history. Hundreds of witnesses were called. There were arguments, lies, tears, and accusations, as intimate details of their private lives were dissected on the world stage. Yet before the court case had even begun, the media had already decided what the verdict should be. However, in Britain and around the world, millions of ordinary people were convinced, and after the inquest still are convinced, that the deaths of Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed were no accident. I wasn't sure if Diana's death was an accident or murder, but I suspected a cover-up by the British establishment, an elaborate exercise in burying the truth rather than uncovering it. I suspected a conspiracy. But this isn't just the old story about a conspiracy before the crash. It's about a conspiracy after the crash.
Professor Laurie Taylor, sociologist.
We all know that the biggest scandals are always the cover-ups. I mean, it isn't the Watergate, it's not the break-in, it's the cover-up which is the big scandal.
Piers Morgan, journalist and television presenter.
When you have the head of the British Security Services calmly announcing we have never killed anybody in the last 50 years, I laughed out loud. What's the point of them then? I didn't believe it. And so if you don't believe that, where does that leave the rest of the establishment evidence?
I decided to watch and wait, then tell the story that the press and TV news wouldn't tell. The result is a documentary that reveals what really happened during those 6 months in the Royal Courts of Justice. It is The Inquest of the Inquest. The royal family likes to present itself as part of a benign and freedom-loving tradition in films such as The King's Speech. As you will have gathered by now, this film is the antidote to The King's Speech. The inquest was held in the royal family's own court, so is it any wonder that the coroner, the royal representative in charge, decided that the key royal suspects need not even appear at the inquest to be questioned?
Richard Wiseman, our undercover reporter.
Right from the inquest's first day, I thought, what if this woman's name had been Diana Smith, and she'd written in a note which had been subsequently unveiled, "My husband Charles Smith wants me to die in a car accident." And subsequently she did. In any other family or in any other country, surely Charles Smith would have been called to the witness stand at the inquest into his wife's death.
Every word you hear from the courtroom has been meticulously reconstructed just as it happened. I also have my own undercover reporter in the press tent, Richard Wiseman, listening to the journalists' conversations. Every word you hear them say was noted down exactly and precisely timed and dated.
I thought when we started that I had about a fortnight before somebody tripped over my notes and realised that I actually wasn't making notes on the inquest, I was making notes on what the other journalists were saying to each other. And the longer it went on, the more I thought, I can't believe I'm getting away with this.
For once, a reporter was doing the dirty on his colleagues, so the world could learn how they only reported one side of the story, ignoring anything that didn't fit their pre-written script.
This looks like 6 months of my life not going to get back.
Day one, 3:45 p.m.
Absolute f***ing nightmare, isn't it? There's a road accident, for Christ's sake, get over it.
Oliver James, clinical psychologist.
Young girls identify with the person who becomes the consort of the king. The big idea of being a princess and becoming queen is a fantasy. There are fairy stories about it. It's a constant fantasy for little girls.
Diana dreamed of becoming a princess too. But unfortunately for her, when her fairy tale fantasy came true, the reality was not a dream. It was a nightmare.
The royal family, it really is true, are much more, at least in that generation, are much more interested in animals than they are in human beings.
The royals are not a sentimental bunch and treat their wives like farmers treat cattle. They're not big on romance. They're very big on breeding.
And I suppose in love.
Of course.
Whatever in love means.
Whatever in love means. Perhaps that was Diana's first intimation that this would be a loveless marriage.
First of all, Mr. Al-Fayed, you have been saying for years that you believe your son was not the victim of an accident, that when he was with Lady Di, the royal family was so upset with her dating him. The fact that he was Muslim, they had him bumped off. In other words, this was a hit, a murder, and not an accident.
Mohammed Al-Fayed, billionaire Egyptian business magnate and sponsor of this film.
Absolutely. He's a terrorist murderer.
Okay.
It's not a murder, it's a slaughter of those bloody racist royal family.
You think Prince Philip is so smart that he can mastermind all of this and orchestrate it?
Yeah, he's vicious. Of course. You think a guy like that will accept my son, different religion, different nationality, will be the future stepfather of the future king? You think this bloody racist family, right, will accept that?
I feel for you. If my daughters were in that car with Lady Di and this was,
of course you'd want to get to the bottom of it.
I'd want to get to the bottom of it, and I don't blame you. Mr. Al-Fayed, just as a background, are you a self-made guy? I mean, did you just come to...
That's right. That's self-made.
Brian Basham, writer.
I think the whole bloody thing's racist.
I think that Mohammed, from the day that he came here and had the temerity to bid for the top people's stall, has been considered to be some sort of a wog, nigger, if you like, who has sort of thrust himself on British society.
Born in Alexandria under British colonial rule, Mohammed quickly left behind his humble Egyptian origins, making a fortune as a middleman for British firms in the Middle East, and whilst doing so, becoming a global billionaire. Proving that it's not where you come from that matters, it's where you end up. And he's ended up in a very nice place indeed.
Besides having owned Harrods for 25 years, Mohammed Al-Fayed owns the Paris Ritz, a villa in Saint-Tropez, a Scottish castle, and a Tudor mansion on the edge of London. But he chooses to spend much of his time in this tent, so he can be close to the burial place of his son, Dodi. He remembers the night of the tragedy all too clearly.
Straight away, going to the mortuary to see Dodi, you know. It was a terrible scene, you know, it was so difficult. And everything worked in my mind, that's definitely there. They killed him. You know, and this is the place which he basically lived most of the time. He liked to play polo. This is the whole field which I planted as a forest. I come sometime here, when I'm here, I have breakfast. I sit with him because we believe soul comes out, you know. Maybe he's watching, his soul watching us, you know, and talking to us.
The crash happened on the 31st of August 1997, the last day of an extraordinary month for Diana. There was the whirlwind romance with Dodi, fevered speculation in the press that she was about to get married, even that she might be pregnant. Where would it all end? Would the mother of the future King of England get hitched to a Muslim and have children by him too and set up a rival court in the USA?
The princess of the world at that time. The girl everybody wanted. I saw him with her. I saw the house in Malibu that Dodi was going to buy for them.
Who knows what might have happened if she'd lived. So whether you think it was an accident or murder, one fact is incontrovertibly true. It was chillingly convenient for the Windsors that Diana died when she did.
The last holiday she spent with her boys, with me for nearly 2 weeks, she was worried and she told me exactly what was going to happen to her.
So she definitely rocked the boat in an extraordinary fashion, and she's still rocking it.
She won't go quietly, that's the problem. I'll fight till the end.
It's day one of the inquest into Diane and Dodie's deaths. Some say the cause was a drunken driver called Henri Paul. Some blame the paparazzi. Others suspect foul play, a staged crash involving a mysterious white Fiat Uno, perhaps on the orders of Prince Philip. The French report into the crash has been kept secret. The British report was riddled with contradictions. Several coroners came and went, and attempts to hold the inquest without a jury were overturned. So here we are, at last, at the start of an inquest that may finally turn the full floodlights onto the workings of the British establishment and the royal family. The media call this the Diana Inquest, forgetting that three people died in that crash, not just Diana, but Dodi Fayed and driver Henri Paul too. Apparently there is a meritocracy even in death, and some demises are considered more important than others. That's me, Keith Allen, outside the Royal Courts of Justice. Note that name, Royal Courts of Justice. A sure sign of impartiality in a case where the credibility of the royal family is on trial. In the Royal Courts of Justice with a judge, or coroner as he's called here, who has sworn an oath of allegiance to the Queen and his Queen's counsellors on every side, and has already said that he is minded not to call senior royals as witnesses.
That's Lord Justice Scott Baker. Stephen Hassler, Professor of Government.
Historically, the relationship between the royal family and the courts has been difficult, mainly because every judge has taken an oath of allegiance to the Queen. Now, if you've taken an oath of allegiance to the Queen, then you have a legal case involving the monarchy, I mean, you're going to be biased, aren't you?
Curiously, the media have decided the outcome of the inquest before it has even begun.
and have already declared it a waste of time and money. Many media organisations, including the BBC, have even sent their royal reporters to cover it rather than their legal reporters.
Our royal correspondent Nicholas Witchell is at the High Court. Nick.
Yet Diana was no longer royal at the time of her death, and BBC royal reporters are required to spend their lives shamelessly sucking up to the palace and presenting the Windsors to the public in a favourable light. So what chance is there of impartiality from them? With most people getting their news about the inquest from journalists with such an obvious bias, I thought it was important that somebody with an open mind also reported on it. Quis custodiet ipsos custodes? Who judges the judges? Well, on this occasion, it seemed to be me and my mole. From the outset, it was clear that the coroner was firmly on the side of the establishment, hardly surprising, as he's part of it.
I thought the story of the opening day would be the coroner points the jury in the direction of it being an accident, which he clearly did, and also the fact he was anticipating what the former leader of the London police was going to say without him being there.
Day 2, 11:14 a.m.
I anticipate that Lord Stevens will give evidence that he was trying to reassure the Pauls that their son had not been as drunk as a pig as had been alleged in some newspapers.
Seems to me that the establishment have been talking to each other and squaring their stories before the inquest gets underway. Why aren't the media suspicious?
This is really fishy. There's something very odd going on around here. And what makes it all the more odd is that the juiciest bits, the bits that are striking me as being the murkiest of all, aren't being reported anywhere. And it wasn't so much that there was a conspiracy amongst other journalists, that there was an established consensus. And anyone who sort of thought or spoke or wrote outside that consensus were regarded as being odd.
Professor Laurie Taylor, sociologist.
This has interesting echoes of The Merchant of Venice. Because if you go back to The Merchant of Venice, I mean, the fundamental point is about Shylock, he's different. He's Jewish in this case, but also Oriental.
Despite what I remember being told at school, Shakespeare's Shylock wasn't actually a bad character at all. He was just a foreigner who wanted justice, but was swindled out of it by the Venetian establishment.
Here's Fayed, the Oriental, going and saying, by the way, I want a fair trial. And they're saying, well, no, just a minute, you know, it's all over. I mean, don't bother about it. Don't be serious. It was an accident. You know, we didn't really mean it. No, he said, I'm coming into court. I'm going to use your judicial system against you. And, of course, he's robbed in court. When you read that, you can also read it as an essay in the way in which the establishment, the Venetian establishment, suddenly find themselves confronted by an outsider who's demanding his rights. He's saying, all I want is justice. Can I have justice, please? You set up all this judicial system. I'd like it, please. And they want to really say, well, it's not for you, you bastard.
The point of the inquest is to investigate the suspicious circumstances surrounding the crash. But will it answer these questions? Was it pure coincidence that Diana told many people she would be deliberately killed in a car crash? Why did the CCTV cameras along the route apparently not record anything? Were driver Henri Paul's blood samples tampered with to make him appear wildly drunk, even though he seemed to be sober? Why were Diana's phone calls being bugged by the American Secret Services? And who was driving the white Fiat Uno that may have caused the crash? Poor Diana. All the royals wanted was a brood mare crossed with a clothes horse. Life did indeed go on for a little bitty while, until the brood mare turned out to be a kicker who bolted through the stable door and went to get her oats elsewhere.
Noel Botham, author of The Murder of Princess Diana.
The establishment didn't want the idea of a future King of England having a Muslim half-brother or sister.
There's only one conspiracy theory, as far as I'm concerned, to do the death of Diana, and that is a conspiracy that's grown up that it was an accident.
Day 3, 2:33 p.m.
Before a single witness had been called.
I think the remaining thing that needs to be done is the jury bailiffs need to be sworn for the journey to Paris. See you in Paris.
This is where the jury will gather to retrace Diana and Dodie's final journey. We'll have to be careful not to film the jury, because we could be sent to prison for contempt if we show their faces, even though anyone who bothers to come here can see perfectly well who they are.
Hotel Ritz, Place Vendôme.
And, oh, look. Oh, there's Posh Spice, who just happens to walk out of the Ritz while the world's cameras are here. Diana was a celebrity who was supposedly hounded by the paparazzi, yet now here's another celebrity using the inquest as a chance for a photo opportunity with the paparazzi. They never learn. Ah, there's the legal charabang. This bus is officially a courtroom, we've been told, and must be treated with the same dignity as the Royal Courts of Justice themselves. But, oh dear, first it appears to have knocked a policeman off his motorcycle and now a tyre has just burst, thereby somehow undermining the majesty of the law. After the jury had visited the crash scene, so did I.
This step.
Where?
Here.
This is it?
Yeah.
Is this the tunnel?
Yeah, you didn't know?
No.
As well as endlessly debating whether Dodie might have impregnated Diana, the inquest devoted several weeks to a minute investigation of her periods, contraceptives and sexual habits. It's almost as though the establishment wanted to demythologise her in the eyes of ordinary people by putting her uterus on public display.
Piers Morgan, journalist and television presenter.
And by going in with Dodie Fayed and falling in love with him, as I believe she absolutely did, head over heels with the guy, you've got the ultimate cocktail of danger for the British establishment.
Perhaps it was unwise for Diana and Dodie to get together, but they clearly fell deeply in love, and thinking about the way their lives were prematurely snuffed out had a strangely melancholic effect on me that night. Right from the start, the circumstances surrounding the crash were suspicious. Within a day, before tests on Henri Paul's blood had even been completed, the French authorities had leaked a story to the press that this was a simple accident caused by a driver who was drunk as a pig. Although the only alcohol he seems to have consumed that night was two Ricards, less than one quarter of the amount the French authorities claimed he'd drunk.
Show some CCTV of him.
He certainly seemed sober minutes before he drove the Mercedes, and within hours of the crash, French police had allowed a road-sweeping van to wash away all the evidence. What a coincidence. That's exactly what the Pakistan police did in 2007, when they immediately hosed down the place where Benazir Bhutto was assassinated. It's so much easier to claim that a death was just an accident if the evidence has been washed away.
Day 73, 2:40 p.m.
It's like my electrician. I was at home last week when he arrived, told him what I was doing, and he immediately turned round and said, oh, yeah, but MI5 did that, didn't they? And the trouble is, intelligent people believe this shit and get carried away with it. I mean, people do love a conspiracy theory, don't they?
Ah, the gentleman of the press. This is the only way most people get to know what's going on at the inquest, and there's no doubt that almost all of the media had already reached their verdict long before the inquest started. Yet most of the hacks covering it didn't understand the detailed evidence they were hearing, and had no idea of how the establishment was manipulating events behind the scenes and deciding what could and could not be said. The coroner even prevented the jury from knowing about the state of the relationship between Philip and Diana. The prince's letters were redacted, as the court called it, or censored into incomprehensibility, as the rest of us call it. When a close friend of Diana's wanted to tell the inquest about deeply hostile letters that the prince had written to Diana not long before her death, she was forbidden to do so.
Simone Simmons, friend of Diana.
Initially, I had great hopes for the inquest, until I got the gagging order on me. Somebody came in and said, oh, you're not allowed to mention the content of the Prince Philip letters. And in effect, it's like having a gagging order slapped on me. The first one was making aspersions on her moral character. It was doubting her faithfulness to Charles before Harry was born. And you just wonder how many people have been paid off in this whole charade. It's not fully transparent. If I've had a gagging order, other people have had a gagging order.
Why weren't the press more suspicious? Well, journalists have to answer to their editors, who answer to their proprietors, who all want knighthoods. The upshot being that most journalists are instinctively pro-establishment and are unwilling to accept that the official story about Diana's death just does not make sense. Well, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it.
This is a television interview with Diana from 1995.
The most daunting aspect was the media attention. And I seem to be on the front of a newspaper every single day. And the higher the media puts you, place you, is the bigger the drop.
Just after midnight on the 31st of August 1997,
Diana and Dodie left the Paris Ritz in a Mercedes driven by Henri Paul. Diana sat in the rear right seat. She habitually wore a seatbelt. But on this occasion, she did not put it on. When the car was subsequently examined by a crash expert on behalf of the Metropolitan Police, the rear right seatbelt was found to be defective. Had it been tampered with? Was this why Diana was not wearing a seatbelt that night? And why was the inquest not told about this? Some of the paparazzi outside the hotel set off in pursuit, but their scooters and motorcycles were unable to keep up with a much more powerful car. Police evidence given at the inquest confirmed that by the time the Mercedes entered the Alma Tunnel, all the pursuing paparazzi had been left far behind. Yet eyewitnesses saw several motorcycles and a white Fiat Uno surrounding the Mercedes and blocking its progress as it entered the tunnel. There was a very bright flash. Then the white Fiat Uno collided with the Mercedes, which lost control and crashed headfirst into a concrete pillar.
Michael Mansfield, QC, counsel to Mohamed Al-Fayed.
All the other vehicles have never been identified. And they've certainly been excluded as being paparazzi because there was a very close analysis done of all the known paparazzi who were on duty that night. And they could all be accounted for.
So, who was riding those motorcycles? Who was driving the white Fiat Uno?
John Morgan, author of two books on the Diana inquest.
Witnesses saw the Mercedes being closely pursued and surrounded by several motorcycles as it drove into the Alma Tunnel. Now, the jury in their verdict found that following vehicles were guilty of manslaughter. The media read following vehicles and translated into paparazzi. Now, the jury never said that.
So the question is, who owned or who was driving the other vehicles, either motorcycle or car?
The jury decided that these unidentified drivers had committed a criminal act. So why are neither the French nor British police trying to trace these killers?
Day 89, 11:20 a.m.
Do MI6 kill people? Are they allowed to? Sir Richard Dearlove said he was unaware of MI6 ever having assassinated anyone.
Piers Morgan.
When you have the head of the British Security Services calmly announcing we have never killed anybody in the last 50 years, I laughed out loud. What's the point of them then? Now, we've all been to James Bond movies, thanks. We know the security services do a lot of dark stuff. So the idea that we're supposed to believe that in 50 years the British secret agents have never actually killed anyone, I didn't believe it. And so if you don't believe that, where does that leave the rest of the establishment evidence?
Of all the lies told to the inquest, the most absurd was that the British secret services have never killed anybody. This shameless lie was exposed by Richard Tomlinson, a former MI6 agent, who gave evidence to the inquest by video link from France. He couldn't come to Britain because if he had, he would have been instantly arrested. Tomlinson saw a secret MI6 plan to assassinate a Serbian leader in a car crash in a tunnel by flashing a very bright light into the driver's eyes.
Richard Tomlinson, former MI6 officer.
At first, I just thought it was a joke, and I refused to believe the officer when he told me about it, because he first of all outlined it to me verbally. And then I went back to see him a couple of days later for another matter, and he sort of gave me a copy of he showed me the minute to sort of prove that he hadn't been joking about it. And so I remember that very clearly.
Baroness Daphne Park, former MI6 senior agent.
Well, there have been other times in my life where I have been involved in death, yes. But I can't talk about that.
Curiously, several witnesses who were near the Alma Tunnel at the time of the crash reported seeing a bright flash seconds before the collision. Have you ever driven at night when some careless driver is coming at you with his headlights on full beam? Imagine that, 100 times as bright in a narrow tunnel. The result would be exactly what happened to Diana and Dodie's car.
I don't think many people would want me to be queen. Actually, when I say many people, I mean the establishment that I'm married into, because they've decided that I'm a non-starter.
The world's slowest ambulance. Lauren Booth, journalist.
The question that haunts me is around the time of the crash, that she wasn't taken more rapidly to a hospital. There was a sort of time period that wasn't properly explained about her treatment on the ground.
The crash occurred at 12:23 a.m. Dodie and Henri Paul died instantly. The bodyguard, Trevor Rees, was seriously injured. Diana was injured, but was conscious and alert. And had she received prompt hospital treatment, she could well have survived, but she didn't. Instead, an ambulance containing Dr. Jean-Marc Martino arrived at the scene. Although other ambulances were also present, he took sole charge of the princess and made a series of bizarre and disturbing decisions that sealed her fate. It took an astonishing 37 minutes after the crash for Dr. Martino to remove the still-conscious Diana from the Mercedes and put her in his ambulance. Odd, because the back of the car was undamaged. It took an extraordinary 81 minutes after the crash before the ambulance even set off for the nearby hospital. Oddly, it made no radio contact with Ambulance HQ throughout the journey. It took an inexplicable 1 hour and 43 minutes after the crash before the ambulance arrived at the nearby hospital, having travelled there at a snail's pace on empty roads. By then, Diana's life was ebbing away. At the inquest, experts agreed that her life could have been saved had it not been for the suspiciously slow and furtive actions of Dr. Martino and his crew, the other members of which have never been officially identified or interviewed.
Day 27, 2:55 p.m.
There is no dispute that at about 12:26, the emergency services in Paris were notified that there had been a serious car crash. There were two dead, two seriously injured. So all it needed at 12:35, if I may say so through you, was one call saying, look, I think we may have a real problem here. Please be at the ready.
Professor Tom Treasure.
That is precisely the conclusion that we would have put in our report.
Day 9, 2:17 p.m, Nicholas Witchell, the BBC's royal correspondent, is asleep in the press tent.
The BBC's chief royal correspondent used to pay particularly close attention. Here's the guy that considers himself to be, effectively, the Walter Cronkite of British television. He's in front of, arguably, the story of the decade. It's unfolding, but he doesn't even have to dig it up. It's happening right in front of him. And the guy falls asleep. And not just once, but several times.
I do things differently, because I don't go by a rule book, because I lead from the heart, not the head. And albeit that's got me into trouble in my work, I understand that. But someone's got to go out there and love people and show it.
There was a powerful reason why the secret services of Britain, France and America might have wanted Diana dead. It was Diana's involvement in the campaign to ban landmines. A worldwide movement to ban anti-personnel landmines gathered speed during 1996. To everyone's surprise, even the world's most powerful politician was sympathetic to the ban.
Bill Clinton speaking in Washington on the 16th of May, 1996.
To end this carnage, the United States will seek a worldwide agreement as soon as possible to end the use of all anti-personnel landmines.
Diana, Princess of Wales, took up the cause with a vengeance. In January 1997, she visited Angola, resulting in the greatest photo opportunity that the landmine campaign had ever had.
One down.
Firing.
Her involvement caused huge anger amongst governments. In Britain, Government Defence Minister Earl Howe denounced her.
Two newspapers this morning quoting unnamed minister described as a loose cannon.
Simone Simmons was with Diana in February 1997, when a government defence minister made a threatening phone call warning the princess to end her involvement with the campaign, otherwise accidents could happen.
The phone went in her little lounge and she picked it up and then called me over, and there was a voice that was in the middle of conversation saying, don't meddle in things you know nothing about. Accidents can happen. She went a bit pale. She took it as a threat. And she said that was Nicholas Soames. I don't know his voice, but it was very, very plummy.
Days before she died, Diana made another visit to landmine victims, this time in Bosnia. Again, there was global press coverage, which made her even more of an enemy to many powerful forces in the armaments industry. Diana was certain that her phones were being tapped by the British secret services.
Every time she'd hear a click, she used to say, boys, time to change the tape.
We now know that her calls were also being monitored by the American Secret Services. After years of denial, they finally admitted to having almost 1,200 pages of transcripts, although they refused to make most of them public, claiming it would threaten national security. Her landmine campaign was clearly infuriating the armaments industry, while her love affair with Dodi Fayed was infuriating the royal family and the British establishment. So there were an awful lot of people who wanted Diana and her Muslim lover dead.
It's weird that at a time when you know the establishment can think of nothing worse than Dodi Fayed, son of Muhammad, marrying and possibly impregnating Diana, that she's conducting a major international offensive against landmines with all the crippling economic problems that would bring for the British establishment again.
And America.
If you add all these to the mix, then if you were ever going to do something dodgy to Diana, that's the time you would do it. She'd become trouble, as she used to say to me. I'm trouble to them. I won't go away. I won't go quietly.
Presidents have been killed for less.
Noel Botham, author of The Murder of Princess Diana.
I think it was an opportunist killing. They had until September the 19th.
Why until then?
Because that was when the conference was going to take place in Oslo on landmines.
Less than 3 weeks after the crash, the key Oslo meeting began. With Diana out of the way, most of the world's press didn't even bother to attend.
When they killed Diana on the 31st of August, 19 days later, Bill Clinton was the only Western leader who voted against a ban on landmines. Something he would never have done...
if she was alive.
...had he had to look in Diana's eyes.
Many investigators believe that this was the real reason Diana was killed. Yet, the coroner barely raised the issue. In the years before Princess Diana was killed, she told many people that the British establishment was planning to eliminate her.
Simone Simmons, friend of Diana.
Oh, of course Diana was bumped off. She knew she was going to be bumped off. She always said she's not going to make old bones.
Diana asked her lawyer, told him that she had from a very confidential source in the palace, Prince Philip, planning to get rid of her in a car accident.
She wrote this letter to her butler, Paul Burrell, telling him that the royal family were planning her death. Diana said the same thing to her lawyer, Lord Mishkin, who made a note of a prediction. This old British establishment lawyer realised that the note could have devastating consequences for the royal family. So 3 weeks after her death, he handed it to Britain's chief policeman, Lord Condon. The police chief also realised its significance, so he concealed it and kept it secret for 3 years.
Day 53, 10:56 a.m. Michael Mansfield, QC, counsel to Mohammed Al-Fayed.
First question, and you've agreed, is there a legal obligation to hand over potentially relevant material? There's an unequivocal answer to that, which is yes. Agree?
Yes, I do.
That was Britain's top policeman admitting that he broke the law by concealing this devastating evidence.
Right. Well, I'm going to make it very plain to you, Lord Condon, that the reason why potentially relevant material was not handed over to the coroner is because you were sitting on it, knowing that something had gone wrong in Paris, linked to the activities of British state agencies.
You are suggesting, are you, that Lord Condon was part of a criminal conspiracy?
Well, I'm suggesting, yes, that he's part of an agreement.
That is one of the most serious allegations that could ever be made of someone in my position, and I unequivocally, totally refute it as a blatant lie.
Fabrice Dubest, French lawyer.
If, in September 1997, this information had gone public, nobody would have spoken anymore about the paparazzi, about Henry Paul. The only thing the whole world would have focused on would have been Diana's fears, Diana's predictions on how she would be killed by the British establishment.
In 1995, Diana summarized her fears in a phone call to a producer of this film.
If you're a strong woman in my environment, you're a problem. So I'm a hell of a problem. I don't have time, an awful lot of time for hobbies, but keeping alive one of them. Keeping alive, keeping alive, keeping alive, keeping alive.
Sadly, she signally failed in this quest. Lord Condon wasn't the only senior policeman to hide the lawyer's note. Lord Stevens, his successor as police chief, concealed it for a further 3 years. Both men broke the law. Both men were made lords by the Queen.
I'd like to be a queen of people's hearts in people's hearts, but I don't see myself being queen of this country.
A very peculiar autopsy.
Diana died soon after arrival at the hospital, and although she had been stripped of her royal status in life, in death her corpse mysteriously became royal property. Within hours, royal representatives had given orders for her body to be partially embalmed, a process that conveniently made it impossible for anyone to tell if she had been pregnant. Attention then turned to the body of the driver, Henri Paul. Before blood tests had even been completed, the French authorities were already insisting that he was drunk as a pig, although the only alcohol he is known to have consumed that night were two single Ricards. This is Henri Paul minutes before the fatal crash. Far from looking drunk as a pig, he seems to be sober as a judge. An autopsy was carried out on Henri Paul's body by Professor Dominique Lecomte, a doctor who is notorious in France for covering up medical evidence that is likely to embarrass the state. If her own account is to be believed, she conducted the world's worst autopsy on the corpse of Henri Paul, committing at least 58 basic errors. Every medical expert at the inquest agreed that her results were not only inept, but biologically inexplicable too, and that her report was untruthful.
Day 56, 10:31 a.m. Richard Keane, QC, counsel to the parents of Henri Paul.
We have Professor Lecomte giving an account of events which on the face of it cannot be true.
Professor Robert Forrest, police pathologist.
So you are pushing at an open door. There are clear inconsistencies in Professor Lecomte's account.
The blood tests carried out by Dr. Pepin were equally unbelievable.
We are all agreed that the explanation offered by Dr. Pepin and Professor Lecomte together for carboxyhemoglobin concentrations in the blood samples is implausible and can be discounted.
Yes, so one is left with either analytical error or a mystery.
Suspicions grew at the inquest that the blood tested by Lecomte and Pepin had not come from Henri Paul at all, not least because it contained lethally high levels of carbon monoxide.
Day 62, 10:45 a.m.
Professor, you said you found it astonishing, the similarity. 1.73, 1.74, 1.75. What are you suggesting there? That suggests to you that the results have been cooked, or what?
Professor Athol Johnston.
That would be my interpretation.
You mentioned that one explanation is that the blood samples didn't, in fact, come from Henri Paul.
That's the most obvious explanation, that it isn't actually Henri Paul's blood we're looking at.
The idea of a classic switcheroo may sound far-fetched, but every scientist involved in the inquest signed a joint statement saying that the blood test results for Henri Paul were biologically inexplicable. Professor Lecomte and Dr. Pepin refused to attend the inquest, even though as citizens of the European Union, they were legally obliged to.
They were protected by the French government, who publicly cited reasons of public order for the refusal. However, it has since emerged that the real reason was the protection of state secrets and the essential interests of the nation.
This is the law the Ministry of Justice has used to help and protect Professor Lecomte and Dr. Pepin. So the fact, the legal fact, is that there are state secrets that are protected and that Professor Lecomte and Dr. Pepin know about.
In 2006, a team of scientists offered to carry out DNA analysis on some of the samples to determine if the blood really was Henri Paul's. They were told by the French authorities that the samples no longer exist.
Well, my husband's side were very busy stopping me. Diana was unstable. They decided that was the problem.
The inquest spent weeks examining Diana's love life in minute detail and considering whether she was pregnant when she died. But why?
Noel Botham, author.
Whether Diana was pregnant or not, or whether she was actually going to marry Dodi Fayed or not, is not important. It's whether the establishment believed she was pregnant or believed she was going to marry Dodi. That's important. And there's no doubt at that moment the majority of them did believe both those things.
What did become clear was that within hours of Diana's death, her body was pumped full of embalming fluid, so no pregnancy tests were possible.
and soon after she had her reproductive organs removed under the watchful eye of the royal coroner.
Mohammed Al-Fayed.
There is a trip, the trip from Paris, from 45, how can you embalm a body and very short distance of travel?
Why do you think they embalmed her, to hide the pregnancy?
Because they had to corrupt the body because she was pregnant. She had to take all her guts.
So, was Diana pregnant at the time of her death? We'll never know for sure, because the French and British authorities destroyed the evidence. And the blood tests which were taken when she arrived at the hospital, and which could have confirmed if she had just become pregnant, have mysteriously vanished. But ask yourself this. Would the British establishment have allowed Muslim blood to enter the royal lineage? And how far would they be prepared to go to stop it happening?
Lauren Booth, journalist and sister-in-law of Tony Blair.
Deep down, we see them now as an establishment that are capable of murder, which is quite serious.
A private phone conversation between Diana and a friend, recorded by the British Secret Service in 1989 and made public in 1992 in an attempt to damage Diana's reputation.
I was very bad, largely, sorry, blubbing. I just felt really sad and full of empty. I thought, bloody hell, what have I done for this family?
If you want to be like me, you've got to suffer.
Would you?
Yep, you have to. And then you get what you...
Get what you want?
No, get what you deserve, perhaps.
Unelected power.
There is no doubt that the entire inquest was skillfully manipulated by powerful unelected forces to the advantage of the royal family. This could only happen because Britain is, in essence, a monarchy, not a democracy. Much of Britain still operates on a system of unelected power. And at its centre are the Windsors, the old aristocracy, and their vast wealth. Just as in medieval times, the royal family live a life of unfettered privilege, with British taxpayers funding their lavish existence.
Professor Stephen Hassler.
Where do we get off on this argument? Only one family, and by the way, a highly unrepresentative family, has the right to a seat to the head of stateship of our country. Now, I think that is a fundamentally flawed argument, and I don't know how it can be used in the modern world.
The idea of a hereditary ruler is as absurd as the idea of a hereditary mathematician.
Officially, the royal family cost British taxpayers £40 million a year, but that's just the tip of a very large iceberg. The royal palaces are maintained by the taxpayer, even private ones, such as Balmoral. Windsor Castle is theirs too, except, of course, when it burnt down, when the bill for rebuilding it also fell on the public purse. Their wealth includes the vast royal art collection, which is worth billions of pounds and belongs to the British people. Yet the people aren't allowed to see it. In return, the royal family refused to obey many British laws, such as the 1968 Race Relations Act. As can be seen from this footage, there are very few non-whites in the royal household. Indeed, it is ironic that the ritual ceremony we are now watching is called Trooping the Colour, because as you can observe, there's barely a non-white face to be seen. The royal family are notorious for their racism. This racism is nothing new. There was a close relationship between the British royal family and the Nazis during the 1930s, details of which remain a closely guarded secret.
Were you surprised when you started to find out about, specifically, the relationship with high-ranking Nazis? I mean, Phillips, especially.
Kitty Kelly, investigative biographer.
I was very surprised when I found out about Phillips' sisters and their connection to Hitler. The fact that the Queen Mother and her husband were inclined more towards Hitler in the beginning.
So why does Britain still tolerate its racist royal family? The only serious argument that defenders of the monarchy can muster nowadays is that the royals are good for tourism, and even that is suspect.
They're not good for tourism.
That's what they say.
Whenever someone says that, I always think, right, so countries that don't have a royal family then, like Ireland or France or America, no tourists ever go there then. Because tourists would go to the top of the Eiffel Tower, look out and go, oh, I don't know, it's not a bad view, but the lack of a monarch spoils it somehow.
Despite presenting itself as a charming and picturesque relic of the past, the royal family retains a ruthless grip on power in 21st century Britain. It presides over a corrupt and corrosive honours system that keeps tens of thousands of public officials in permanent obedience to the monarchy, all hoping for a knighthood or an OBE. in return for a lifetime's loyal service. These are the people who operate Britain's system of government. Judges, coroners, civil servants, police chiefs, permanent private secretaries, members of the secret services and privy councillors.
When I became a cabinet minister, I was made a privy councillor. You swear that you will protect the Queen from all foreign prelates, potentates and powers, and you will report on colleagues if they're disloyal and so on. And they read it to me, and I said at the end, I didn't agree. And they said, you don't have to agree. So I said, what do you mean? They said, we've administered the oath. Now, that phrase, the administration of oaths, which people would have heard, means you're injected with the oath. I've been injected with an oath.
The royals don't only use honours and oaths of allegiance to preserve their power. They use intimidation too, as Diana found to her cost. They demand absolute secrecy and loyalty from their subjects, and they stifle dissent.
Dr. Piers Brendan, historian.
I think of the establishment, our establishment, as a kind of a legal mafia, whose watchword really is the watchword of the real mafia, omerta, silence.
That's why many people regard them as gangsters. Gangsters in tiaras. And given Prince Philip's Nazi background, is it really so unthinkable that those at the top of the present-day British establishment might go to any lengths to rid themselves of a turbulent princess?
Well, anything good I ever did, nobody ever said a thing, never said well done or was it okay. But if I tripped up, which invariably I did, because I was new at the game, a ton of bricks came down on me.
Day 61, 4:18 p.m.
Still. Successful producer, Dodie, wasn't he? I mean, what did he ever produce? That's what he produced. He produced his inquest by dying, you know. Successfully getting himself killed. He's just the typical rich man's son, you know. Talentless son of a rich father, then pisses all his dad's money out the wall. You think of that stereotype? And that's Dodie.
The media called this the Diana inquest, forgetting that it was also an inquest into the death of Dodie Fayed. In life, Dodie was described by the Duke of Edinburgh as an oily bedhopper. In death, he was dismissed by the press as a worthless playboy. But the inquest revealed these descriptions to be wholly untrue.
He loved to make movies. He liked that ability to make movies. That was his chosen profession.
The other good thing that came out of the inquest, why it was successful, is that it cleared Dodie's name. The evidence was overwhelming about the kind of guy he was. Not a playboy. Actually, straightforward, really caring, sensitive, funny man.
He was smart, Dodie. He understood everything about his father's profession and his profession. He told me on so many occasions, I want to run a studio. I want to have a studio of my own.
Dodie first showed his cinematic talent in 1981 as executive producer of the Oscar-winning film Chariots of Fire.
But Chariots of Fire... Think of any British movie have four Oscars in the same time.
So it's ostensibly a film about a Jew taking on the establishment.
That's right. I mean, the racism, you know, again. And this was unbelievable. Way of thinking that he have the idea.
Following the crash in 1997, there was an outpouring of grief for Diana in the press. But the media virtually ignored Mohammed Al-Fayed's devastation over the loss of his son, Dodie.
I've seen him crying, telling me how he shared a bed with Dodie every day of his life from 2 to 13, after his mother left. When you hear things like that, you know how close they were.
Some questions regarding the mysterious Henri Paul.
Despite lasting 6 months and claiming to be an in-depth investigation, the inquest failed to find answers to many basic questions regarding Henri Paul. If he really was a chronic alcoholic, this would have been diagnosed during the stringent medical examination he underwent 3 days before the crash while renewing his pilot's license. But he passed the medical with flying colours. So why wasn't the doctor who gave him a clean bill of health called to the inquest or ever interviewed by the police? Why did Britain's top policeman, Lord Stevens, tell Henri Paul's parents in 2006, in front of other policemen who kept a written record of the conversation, that their son was definitely not drunk? Yet 6 weeks later, Lord Stevens published a report claiming that Henri Paul was drunk. So, who was lying, Lord Stevens or Lord Stevens? After the crash, the police searched Henri Paul's apartment twice.
The first time, all the police found was an unopened bottle of champagne and a quarter bottle of martini, which hardly supports the claim that he was an alcoholic. So the police returned a few days later. And, would you believe it, this time they claimed to have found enough alcohol to stock an entire bar. Beer, wine, Ricard, bourbon, vodka, port, champagne, cassis, peanut. The inquest heard undisputed evidence of Henri Paul's links to the French secret services, the Direction de la Surveillance du Territoire, and to Britain's MI6.
Richard Tomlinson, former MI6 officer.
I just remember reading his file and thinking it was interesting that, first of all, they had a Frenchman working for MI6, because it's actually quite rare to find someone who is French who prepared to work for MI6, because they quite often don't. And secondly, because I'm a pilot myself, I remember this particular person having an interest in flying.
So why did the coroner tell the jury in his summing up that Henri Paul had no links to the security services? Henri Paul's bank accounts show he received a total of 350,000 French francs of unexplained income during the final months of his life, mostly from checks. Why didn't the inquest establish who had written those checks, or examine the transactions made on Henri Paul's 5 credit cards, or allow the jury to see his mobile phone records? Why did Henri Paul go missing from the hotel for 7 minutes at 10:36? Was he meeting an accomplice in the Place Vendôme? What about the gesture that Henri Paul made outside the Ritz moments before driving off in the Mercedes? Was it a signal to an accomplice? If the inquest had failed to answer one or two of these simple questions, you might put it down to incompetence. But its failure, even to ask many of them, can only have happened because the authorities already knew the answers and wanted to keep them hidden. Henri Paul was not drunk and was working for the secret services on the night that he died. Day 68. The only senior representative of the royal household to appear at the inquest was Sir Robert Fellowes, the Queen's private secretary. On day 68, while under oath, he had the following interchange with Michael Mansfield. Were you on holiday at the time? I was on holiday from early, well, somewhere around the first week of August. Until? The week after the death of the Princess and Mr. Al-Fayed. And I went back to Balmoral on the following Sunday, I think, after the funeral. So, would it be fair to say that you were not, in fact, therefore, at the palace or nearby when all of this was happening? I was at the palace, certainly, until the end of July. Fellowes unequivocally told the inquest that he was on holiday for the entire period before and after Diana's death and did not return to work until after her funeral. Now, let's move to January 2011 and the publication of the diary of Tony Blair's press secretary, Alastair Campbell. 31st August. At about 4 a.m, I got a flavour of the royal establishment's approach when I had a conference call with Robert Fellowes. You know about Diana, do you? She's dead. It was all very matter-of-fact. 1st of September, meeting at the Lord Chamberlain's office, attended by Robert Fellowes. 2nd of September, 10 a.m, Fellowes and I had a discussion. 3rd of September, Fellowes called early. 4th of September, I had another discussion with Fellowes. 5th of September, Fellowes said we had all worked well together. Far from being on holiday, as he had claimed under oath, Fellowes was at the very centre of Diana's funeral arrangements, overseeing her burial throughout the week. Fellowes was the man that Diana had described to friends as one of the three names that I fear. He hates me. He will do anything to get me out of the royals. Sir Robert Fellowes was made a lord in 1998.
There's a quote from Prince Philip. In the event that I am reincarnated, I would like to return as a deadly virus in order to contribute something to solve overpopulation.
This little boy is called Philip. His full name is Philip Schleswig Holstein Sonderberg Glucksberg, and he grew up in Germany. He was raised amongst his Nazi in-laws, some of whom later became high-ranking members of the SS. His Nazi relatives then sent him to this school in southern Germany, where he studied for a while under the Nazi curriculum. Philip later recalled that there was much heel-clicking and shouts of Heil Hitler were compulsory. And here's Philip, in Darmstadt, in the heart of Germany, in November 1937, attending a family funeral for some of his Nazi in-laws. Marching in front of a Sieg Heiling crowd, this is Philip, next to Christoph, his SS brother-in-law, and Philip, his Nazi stormtrooper brother-in-law. Imagine if a man with a past like this had somehow ended up marrying into British aristocracy.
Well, he did.
And as we know,
he got first prize. He became the Duke of Edinburgh, also known as Prince Philip, after marrying Princess Elizabeth, the future Queen of England.
British lawyers have warned us of 87 legal issues concerning this film. Several of those warnings concern the following interview.
And this is with Oliver James, a clinical psychologist.
I think Prince Philip is somebody who is devoid of any internal sense of right and wrong. So deep down, he cares nothing about anybody else. He regards everybody else as potentially a threat. He is completely selfish. And that is very like Fred West or any other psychopathic individual.
Oliver James is one of Britain's leading clinical psychologists. Yet lawyers told us that we could not include his professional diagnosis of Prince Philip in this film. So we looked for the current medical definition of psychopathy and discovered that most psychopaths are not convicted criminals but function normally in society. We also found that psychopaths tend to gravitate towards highly paid professions, such as the legal profession and, oh dear, us, filmmakers. Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip have traditionally been presented to the public as role models for the rest of society. But why?
Noel Botham.
Certainly. I mean, Philip's been in half the beds of England, including two of his wife's close family. But, do you want me to say that?
Or yes, go on.
Princess Margaret and Princess Alexander.
Stop it.
Oliver James.
I don't think that she was somebody who was a kind of would have wanted to marry a psychopath. I think she must have got a very nasty shock when she found out quite how unpleasant he is. But obviously, being the sort of person she is, she said, well, that's it. You know, I've got to stick with this and he's going to shag anything that moves and I can't do anything about that. That's what they all do anyway, isn't it?
Almost everyone has heard rumours about Prince Philip's innumerable extramarital affairs. Yet newspapers have never published full reports, whereas they routinely expose the affairs of pop stars, footballers and other celebrities. Why? Because in Britain, the media dare not challenge the authority of those at the very top.
Oliver James.
I have a friend of mine who was at a party where he had to observe the disgusting sight of Prince Philip wearing a leather jacket, dancing to a Stones song with his hand halfway up the skirt of some young woman. And that's not an unusual event at all for Prince Philip. He's done that sort of thing many times.
This isn't a question of morality. It's a question of media cowardice. The British press usually love nothing more than exposing the peccadilloes of eminent people, all except senior members of the royal family who are mysteriously exempt. Funny, that. You may think that we should have given Prince Philip a right of reply in this film. Well, we did, but he declined our invitation, as did the entire royal family. And they are not the only ones. In fact, if you're wondering why you're not hearing from any members of the British establishment in this film, it's certainly not for want of trying on our part. We asked all of these pillars of the establishment to take part, and they all refused. I wonder why.
The White Fiat Uno.
What you are seeing is what the CCTV camera at the entrance to the Armour Tunnel was recording at the time of the crash. Nothing. Because it was switched off, even though it was usually switched on 24 hours a day. Was that just another coincidence? Or something more sinister? Even though no cameras recorded the crash, it is beyond doubt that a white Fiat Uno collided with Dodie and Diana's car in the tunnel and contributed to their deaths. The French police tried to deny its existence at first, but too many eyewitnesses saw it, and paintwork from a white Fiat Uno was found on the Mercedes where the two cars had collided. So, who was driving it? Suspicions fell on James Anderson, a photographer with connections to the Secret Services. He had been following Dodie and Diana earlier in the month during their holiday in the Mediterranean, but he was not amongst the paparazzi who were waiting outside the Paris Ritz on the night of the crash.
Noel Botham, author of The Murder of Princess Diana.
Anderson was a millionaire paparazzo, a very well-known member of the paparazzi on the continent, made a great deal of money out of royal pictures. Lived in some style in the French countryside.
He told police that he wasn't in Paris on the night of the crash, but gave two completely different accounts of where he had been. His wife and son also gave him contradictory alibis. Privately, he told friends that he had been there in the tunnel in Paris that night. Crucially, Anderson owned a white Fiat Uno.
Brian Basham, writer.
It was said of this Fiorduno that it was up on chocks and didn't work. Well, that appears to be untrue, too. It was driven many hundreds of miles around the French countryside. So the whole question of the Fiorduno and who was driving it, which is, of course, absolutely crucial, totally crucial to the investigation, has never been resolved. And you have to say, why?
In May 2000, Anderson's body was found in a blazing car in woodland near Montpellier.
In a Ministry of Defence field, shooting range field, in a car which was burned out and locked, but no keys were in the car or in his pocket. And the police claimed he committed suicide.
They claimed this, even though the fireman who found him says he saw two bullet holes in Anderson's skull. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to point out that it's difficult for a man to shoot himself twice in the head and then set fire to his own car before dying.
I would like a monarchy that has more contact with its people.
By the end of the inquest, so much suspicious evidence had been heard that the establishment coroner could take no chances. So he prevented the jury even considering murder as an option. His summing up lasted almost 3 days, during which he continually distorted the evidence, ignored much of the eyewitness evidence, and tried to convince the jury that the crash was nothing more than an accident.
At the start, I told you it was not necessary to solve every subplot in the story.
There are certain matters relating to Henri Paul that simply cannot be resolved with any clarity.
You've not heard in person from Professor Lecomte, Dr. Pepin and others concerned with the analysis of Henri Paul's samples.
In common with most road traffic accidents, this collision did not appear to have a single cause.
The relationship between Diana and Dodie had reached the point where it could no longer be tolerated.
The conspiracy theory has been minutely examined and shown to be without any substance.
Will you please now retire to consider your verdicts?
But the one thing the establishment and the royal courts couldn't fix was the jury. 11 ordinary men and women who ignored the coroner's one-sided summing up and instead spent almost a week examining the evidence for themselves.
Richard Wiseman, diary entry. It's day 93 and we're still waiting for the verdict. Nobody around me can understand why the jury are taking so long. The hacks all expected a verdict of accidental death to be returned within seconds.
Did you see those sandwiches they just took in for the jury? Yeah, I mean, my worry is they look far too good. You know, if they'd given them some curled up, you know, they'd agree by two, give the verdict by three, and be home by four.
Fact is, it's becoming painfully obvious that the jury, unlike the press, bothered to listen to the evidence, and they are now analysing it very, very carefully.
A year after the inquest into the deaths of Princess Diana and Dodi Al-Fayed, we asked a cross-section of ordinary people what the jury's verdict was.
Accidental death.
Purely an accident.
It was accident.
It was accidental.
Accidental death.
It was an accident.
Accidental death, I believe.
It was an actual accident.
Accidental death.
Accidental death.
The answers the public gave us were uniformly inaccurate.
They said the paparazzi, didn't they?
The paparazzi chasing her?
I think, yes, it was for the paparazzi.
Around the world, people have been massively misled by the British media into believing that the deaths were an accident caused by the paparazzi. But in reality, the jury did not blame the paparazzi, and they decided that the crash was not a mere accident, but something much more serious.
Day 94, 4:07 p.m.
In the end, the jury delivered the most powerful verdict that the coroner had left open to them. Unlawful killing is defined in law as homicide or manslaughter. And the jury blamed the following vehicles, not the paparazzi.
Michael Mansfield, QC.
What is also interesting, overlooked, I think, almost totally by the media and commentators, was the wording of the verdict. Well, the detail of this verdict was such that it was an unlawful killing contributed to by, and one of the factors was, following vehicles, not the paparazzi.
No. Initially, journalists were confused, but within minutes, the BBC was reporting that the jury had blamed the paparazzi, and the rest of the media followed the example of the British establishment's impartial broadcaster. Soon, the verdict had been spun by the media into an accident,
caused by the paparazzi. And so, a lie got halfway around the world while the truth was still putting its boots on. The altered verdict was still on the BBC's news website at the time of making this documentary.
Whether it was a case that the commentators, in the end, wanted it to be the paparazzi, and so immediately assumed that, and hadn't, and often some of them didn't really follow it on a daily basis. They might read in the odd transcript. And certainly a change of that kind, which was very important because following vehicles was a much bigger category than just paparazzi because of the reasons I've just given, that nobody either wanted to understand what that meant, or if they did, weren't prepared to include it in their commentary.
The media declared that Mohammed Al-Fayed had been defeated. But in reality, the jury's verdict supported what he'd been saying all along. Diana and Dodi were unlawfully killed. 2011, and the British media, after seriously misreporting the verdict, refuse even to discuss what the verdict really means. Their deafening silence speaks volumes about the deeply troubling outcome.
Oliver James.
There was a feeling of openness about it. And yet, at the end of it, I have to say, even as a supposedly educated scientific person, I would still say I don't feel that at all confident that it got to the bottom of it.
Laurie Taylor.
People will still go on thinking there is something happening here because they know the British establishment, they know their capacity for cover-ups. The newspapers in this country really don't want to upset the very top.
Lauren Booth.
The most bizarre thing is that normal people in this country who don't necessarily enjoy conspiracy theories, if you go to a bar, you'll find three people who go, ooh, but the royals did it, didn't they?
Piers Morgan.
I think most of the British public still believe it was dodgy. I believe Mohammed Al-Fayed will always believe it's dodgy. I believe the establishment want it all to just go away for whatever reason, and I don't know the answers to these questions. All I know is that the inquest has probably raised more questions than in the end it answered, and it answered a lot of questions.
Oliver James.
I would still say it was fantastically convenient for the monarchy that this woman died. Just think what she might be saying now if she hadn't died. Think what a problem it would have created for Camilla. Think of, it would have created serious constitutional problems that even she was perfectly capable of being somebody who started a movement to end the monarchy.
The full facts about the Alma Tunnel crash may never be known, but we do know this for certain. Dodi and Diana were the victims of an unlawful killing, and various parts of the establishment, with their unerring instinct for mutual self-preservation, then seemed to have rallied around to cover it up. They covered for each other and suppressed uncomfortable facts, and they think that they have got away with it. The British establishment think that they have got away with murder. But then what's new? They've been getting away with murder for centuries. Since the crash, some curious things have happened. Charles has married Camilla, as he'd always wanted to. MI6 now publicly admit that they have been involved in killings. Diana has been airbrushed out of official royal history. No action has been taken against the police chiefs who suppressed Diana's sworn statement predicting that the royal family would kill her in a car crash. Instead, they both now sit in the House of Lords. Mohammed Al-Fayed was ordered by Prince Philip to take down the royal warrants that had hung for decades outside Harrods. And shortly before selling the store in 2010, and more in sorrow than in anger, he symbolically burned them in sight of his son's grave.
I am destroying this royal crest as a tribute to my son, Dodi. I feel that he is looking down on this today. There was a clear verdict of unlawful killing. So why has nobody been arrested? What is at the core of all this is racism. Powerful people in this country, my country, don't want to hear me talking about Prince Philip's Nazi background, but I have to, because it's just 100% true. They wouldn't accept me or my son. And when he fell in love with Diana, they murdered them.
Despite obtaining a verdict that vindicates his years of struggle, Mohammed Al-Fayed fights on. Still grieving for his son, he has opted for truth rather than happiness. Legal action is continuing in France against the police chiefs who suppressed vital evidence, and the establishment cover-up is being steadily exposed day by day. Truth will out. And as more and more people come to understand what the damning inquest verdict really means, we may soon witness what the British establishment fears most. The end of the monarchy.
Now we move across the Atlantic for more suppressed information. This is Dean Puckett interviewing Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed about an interview he had with whistleblower Sybil Edmonds. This is the third Crisis of Civilization podcast, and it was published in May 2013.
I'm Dean Puckett. I'm the director of the documentary The Crisis of Civilization, and you can find me and my other film work at deaddeanfilms.co.uk. I'm here today with Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed, the author of The User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization and How to Save It. Our podcast today is going to focus on a new article that Nafees is writing about the FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds. Nafees, maybe you could just tell the listeners who Sybil Edmonds is and a little bit about her.
Sybil Edmonds is a former FBI translator who was contracted by the FBI to translate intelligence that they had been developing in the years prior to and up to 9/11. And she specializes in kind of in Persian, Turkish, Azerbaijani languages. And she got her job shortly, a couple of weeks after the 9/11 attacks, when the FBI was kind of obviously scrambling to develop a kind of big picture understanding of what the hell had happened, and had realized that their language capabilities were pretty dismal and they needed to bring new people in. So Sybil Edmonds began working for the FBI. I think it was late September she actually got the contract in 2001. And she worked with them for about 6 months or so, and then she ended up being fired. And what subsequently emerged from all of this experience that she had at the FBI was a spate of quite shocking revelations about high-level corruption in the US national security system, starting at the lowest levels of the FBI in the Washington field office where she was working, going all the way up to the Pentagon, the US State Department, the CIA, the Justice Department, the US Cabinet, as well as congressmen from both parties. And it was a really, really entrenched web of corruption that she'd uncovered.
And in researching this article, you've had a long recorded Skype chat with her, which we'll cut to intermittently through the podcast.
So I'm recording now.
Okay.
You are the most gagged woman in American history. And I mean, arguably, probably the most gagged person, you know, in modern times. It's really amazing. What is it about what you discovered in this? Was it about 7 months, 9 months, or something? You were working for the FBI. What was it that you discovered that was so explosive that you brought the entire machinery of the U.S. government on your head?
Let me start with my languages. My primary language is Turkish. The secondary language, it would be almost equal, is Farsi, the language spoken in Iran. And because of that, I'm also able to, not as a verbatim pro, but I understand a lot of Dari language. Dari language is about 80%. It's like a Persian Farsi dialect. Azerbaijani is because of my father's background, and of course English, because both I studied in English in Turkey, but then I came and I went to universities here. My degrees is very simple. I have two bachelor's degrees. I have one in criminal psychology, the other one in criminal justice from George Washington University. Yeah, you're right. They consider this classified. But then yeah. I got a master's degree in public policy, U.S. public policy from George Mason University. And my work background up until the work that I did with the FBI, I never worked for the government. I did some volunteer work for the criminal justice system in Virginia for juvenile court in Alexandria. I dealt with sexually abused children. And other than that, it's been private business. I traveled extensively until 2000. I had one job temporarily in Russia right after the fall of the Soviet Union, 1992, 1993, with Rostropovich Foundation, which dealt with children hospitals in back then Leningrad, St. Petersburg. Now, with the FBI, I want to emphasize, like, I did not discover anything by myself.
Yeah.
These investigations, operations were ongoing since 1996 and not through one field office. That was where I work, FBI Washington, D.C. field office, but also FBI field offices elsewhere, especially specifically in Chicago. And these discoveries and all the suspicions of some of the activities that later through investigation produced explosive results were being carried out long before I joined the FBI. Well, what happened was, since it was right after 9/11, and since these different field offices and different operations being separated both through bureaucracy but also intentionally, for example, FBI, Turkish counterintelligence could not talk with or share information with FBI Turkish Criminal Division, and the FBI Criminal Division could not share information and work together with FBI Turkish Counterterrorism Division, because of these separations, that a lot of it was intentional, some of it was due to bureaucracy. So what happened was, I came in there, and I will get into it really more in detail, because it really needs to be explained how and what operations we are talking about. I ended up working, because I was the only language specialist, and up until after 9/11, 3 days after 9/11, FBI was not allowed to have an official Turkish division, whether it's counterintelligence, counterterrorism. They could carry out some monitoring under FISA and pursue some criminal investigations, but they could never have a division that is officially called Turkish division. Wow. They could never have a division that is called UK division, even though we had all the other European countries' division. We had a French division, which, you know, we monitored, when I say we, FBI analysts and translators, their embassy and attaché information, etc. Germany, we did. All, you know, South American countries, we did. Turkey, UK, and Belgium. Three countries, and to a certain extent, Azerbaijan.
Wow, so FBI was so these four countries were
forbidden.
So these four countries had, the FBI could not, did not, was not allowed, essentially, to wiretap them. But they were...
Well, they did, but they were not given any power to pursue the results of any investigations. First of all, the divisions were not official. While the other, for example, FBI has a huge Israel division, okay? It's one of the biggest ones. You know, there's Iran and the Saudi Arabia and all the Arab-speaking nations. But then Israel has a huge division, okay? Yeah. Even though it's an official division, it has a name, the FBI Israel Counterintelligence Division, Israel Criminal Division. So they have it. They have the power to wiretap as well. But because of political reasons, FBI is always, almost 99.999%, they are forbidden. They are prevented from implementing further actions, whether it's going to courts on espionage cases or if it's criminal cases. That's due to political pressure.
Right.
Now, Turkey and UK and Belgium, the UK embassies cannot be tapped. Okay, that is just. But while you can tap completely the military attaché for, let's say, Turkey and the Turkish embassy and Turkish NGOs or Turkish lobby firms, since it is not recognized as official And if you find incredible terrorism or espionage cases, you are in a really bad situation in terms of pursuing and doing something about it. Okay? Same. Now, even though it's official for Israel division in the FBI, with them, with Israel, is the political pressure. Because, you know, once in a while we hear about, oh, certain wiretaps that came out and implicated a certain congresswoman on AIPAC. Well, AIPAC has known for a long time that they are being wiretapped. And they're so bold. They're like, they don't care because they know that people can't take action. They are prevented by the political powers. Because who is FBI answerable to? It's the executive branch and ultimately is answerable to the White House, okay? DOJ White House. And so while you have agents who are, let's say, within this Turkish division, they're working because they find explosive operations, you know, whether it's narcotics related or it's espionage related against Turkey. And they have actually channels to pursue it and bring these people to justice, whether it's the U.S. counterparts or the Turkish criminals here in the United States through criminal prosecution channels. But then their hands are tied because you have the White House, which takes order from the CIA and the State Department, telling the top layer, maybe the top four or five guys. So all the agents I work with in the FBI, they were really good and they were doing their work, okay? They were good. They were really pursuing these true, real terrorism or criminal or espionage cases. Mm. The top layer answerable to the White House and influenceable completely by the State Department, the CIA, were the ones who were coming and saying, we are shutting down this investigation. Or I give one example that may illustrate it. Besides gathering and collecting information, the agents, also FBI agents, conducted field operations. Mm. In one case, we had a Turkish target or targets several individuals under a certain operation. This one was done through Washington, D.C. field office agents. And these targets, we had information about how they were going to bring certain kilogram of heroin through what channel, and it was going to be somewhere in D.C., okay? Mm. And the field operation, the FBI, and also DEA, this is Drug Enforcement Agency, also was included because this was a joint operation, right? So that morning at 9:15, this particular thing was going to take place, and the DEA agents and the FBI agents, they were having this field operation, and they were going to go. They were going to bust these guys, okay? So they are actually in a van, several SUVs. This is the FBI agents, the DEA agents. And about 15, 20 minutes before the bust, the FBI headquarters, and this is the top, you know, SES level, senior executive level, they contact the field agents in the van, and they say, you call it off. You turn around, and you get the DA agents off. This is called off. Now, agents are pissed. They are like, what? How could this be? I mean, we have all the stuff, and we cannot give you any explanation. This is the two of the targets have diplomatic immunities. Well, we knew that they were not diplomats, okay? But FBI says, no, well, somebody in the top-level FBI had shared that information with people in the State Department. So between the State Department and the White House, the director's office was being told to call off the operation. Turn around. You're not making this bust. This operation is just – it's terminated at this point, ASAP. You're returning back to the field office.
So when was this incident?
Well, this is one of many incidents. This particular incident took place in, it would be around end of October 2001. But again, the agents I work with, I mean, and with the files, operations, not only on these particular guys, but other connected target guys, they have had similar things happening to them over and over and over since the beginning of this particular operation in 1996.
These targets were related to this particular operation What was the investigation? What were these investigations about?
Well, this investigation, well, FBI's part was they were after these guys because they also had some operation centers in New Jersey, and they brought in, you know, heroin. And this, the source of heroin, I'm not going to go all the way to the original source, but from Turkey to Belgium, from Belgium into the United States.
Yeah.
And, well, let's say if you had four targets, foreign targets, okay, and let's say one of them had a green card but still had dual citizenship, and out of these four targets, two of them were directly connected to Pentagon and the military attaché of Turkey, but they didn't have diplomatic titles.
I see.
So you have a case where there are people who are working with Pentagon, NATO, and the Turkish military attaché who are bringing heroin into the United States. DEA knows about it, the good agents. The FBI knows about it. They want to go and make a buzz because this guy doesn't have an official diplomatic cover. But yet, the State Department, a.k.a. CIA, and the White House, they tell them, you terminate this operation. Because what's going to happen? You arrest these guys, this thing comes out, their identities, who they are, the operations. Now you're implicating high-level Turkish military, NATO, and the United States operations military operators. Can you imagine what would happen?
What you're saying is that one of the reasons it seems that this was blocked was because people inside the US government at a senior level actually condoned in some way this criminal activity, this heroin trafficking and all the rest of it. They were actually in some way involved, and they didn't want that involvement to come to light through this operation. Is that
not only that they were involved, they actually participated.
Yeah.
We had well-documented investigation cases that showed a lot of heroin entered the United States through a military plane that landed in Andrews Air Force Base. Okay, one of my whistleblowers, John Cole, he was one of the managers for the counterintelligence, okay, in FBI headquarters. Well, he tried to blow the whistle.
Wow.
Okay, so you have, it's not that, okay, they know, but because they are allies and they are having other use for us, we look the other way. No, that was not the case. It was, see, this is the whole thing. After I came back from Vietnam, there's a guy who was one of the top attorneys with the Justice Department, not the FBI. And he retired in 2005, 2006. He's not a whistleblower or anything, and he's like one of the system guy. And he said, you know what, Sabel? That's one of the mistakes, I believe, the DOJ and the State Department, because the decision for the state secrets privilege didn't originate from the FBI. The DOJ implemented it, but the decision came from the State Department, CIA, that they needed to enforce state secrets privilege. My case had to be stopped from any, you know, proceeding in courts. But he said that was their biggest mistake because they panicked, okay? Hmm. But with what you know and what you could have taken out, even though you were not supposed to document-wise from the FBI, that if they let you just talk and take this stuff out there, nobody would have believed anyway.
Yeah.
So they actually made a big tactical mistake because they even gave more attention in some ways and legitimacy by saying, we cannot let her open her mouth.
Yeah.
You let her open her mouth. Well, if I had really gone to court and testified under oath, and I would have said something like, okay, here is the particular office in Pentagon, and here is a particular office in the State Department, and this is the division within NATO that, which is part of it, is the Turkish division of NATO, because Turkey is a NATO ally, and they're engaged in this, including heroin, nobody would have believed me. It would have sounded insane.
The situations that you're describing here, when you go into detail in your book and you explain all of the various strands of investigations that you ended up translating intelligence in relation to, they really are just small facets of this web of criminal activity on the one hand, some of it was just there was bureaucracy, and there was what you might expect in any organization. There's a lot of bureaucracy and blah blah blah, red tape. Then there were other layers. So the next layer that I thought was interesting was this kind of criminal negligence.
For example, let me give you start with three points, so that way everything will start maybe making more sense. You just mentioned translation, and I want to also clarify something else here. So let's say you are wiretapping or monitoring a military attaché, Turkish military attaché, and let's say embassy, right? Well, sure, there will be communications that are in Turkish between Turkish actors, targets, right? Some of them are non-targets who are just calling, and you by default hear it, and you know, you're the translator, you translate it. But I would say close to 40, 50% of those communications didn't have to be translated because they were carried out in English, okay? So when Wiretap brings this information to the FBI, it doesn't distinguish which ones are in English, which ones are in Turkish. Now, the targets may be Turkish or Pakistanis, but a lot of conversations are in English. One example of this would be there was a very heated period between summer 2001, and these are both archive and later live monitoring, where on daily basis we sat and listened to Paul Wolfowitz talking to the top military attaché guy, you know, Turkish military attaché, okay, on Iraq. This was before we invaded Iraq. And there were a lot of discussions. There was a lot of they were trying to get, and this is Paul Wolfowitz, the Turkish military, saying, this was actually plans on going and invading Iraq, and Turkey, in order to have U.S. use the base, etc., they had one condition, one important condition Turkey was putting there and demanding was like, you let us handle northern Iraq, you know, the whole Kirkuk region, because we have our own interests there with the Kurds and everything. Well, the plan was only United States and United Kingdom. And they said, well, you don't do that, we're not going to let you use our damn base. And the middle guys, they're not the top guys, Wolfowitz, were trying to get this thing mild and saying, come on now, look, initially we will do it, but within the first few years, then we would let you to participate in some of the stuff, you know, with Iraq. But initially, we do not want to have that kind of a mess in the northern border. Well, so what I'm trying to say is all this conversation was in English. They didn't need a translator, but it came through the same cable, through the same wiretap. So to hear almost on daily basis Richard Pearl or Paul Wolfowitz talking to the highest level guy in Turkish embassy was a regular occurrence. And agents were able to directly listen to it too. And when you listen, I mean, so much you were finding out that was just mind-boggling. Now, the most troubling, the most important aspect of this case, the state secrets privilege, ended up tying directly to 9/11.
Yeah.
Because the previous, some of them, they were shut down. That's why I'm referring to as previous investigations. They were shut down by the end of 2001, early 2002. Investigations produced all these evidence, documented evidence in the FBI that made it very clear that we, the United States, up until 2001, including at the time of 9/11, we had very close joint operations with Ayman Zawahiri, with Bin Laden, not only one Bin Laden, several Bin Laden family members, including Osama Bin Laden, okay? We had meetings with them in Baku, in Azerbaijan, the U.S. Embassy in Azerbaijan in Baku.
When did those meetings take place?
So there were at least three or four meetings, two of them with Zawahiri, and we had actually from U.S. people going and attending that meeting in the U.S. Embassy, including people such as Prince Bandar was in there. We had several known Turkish figures, 1997, 1998, the last one being in late 1999 in Azerbaijan, in Baku, in U.S. Embassy.
And the Turkish figures, were they, those were military intelligence or government? Who were these people?
This was Well, one of them was the highest level Turkish general, that is the NATO, Turkish NATO general.
I see.
But also it included a very high level religious figure, which maybe we'll get into it later. This made the entire thing with 9/11 and what the government was saying completely moot.
So it's really a massive and complex web of things that she brings to the fore, which is why I think it's important that people actually read her book and understand how complex the things are, but also how ridiculously facile the picture is that is presented to us in the media about terrorism.
I've taken a lot of heat for saying it goes back to the Crusades.
Barely 100 years after Muhammad's death, the Islamic Empire had spread far and wide. The Pope reacted to the Muslim expansion by launching Christendom's version of holy wars, the Crusades.
And you can just see it happening again.
This kind of, quote, clash of civilizations.
And this could be a defining moment
that the world needs to march forward
to deal with the scourge of
the bearded ones
and see what they have done against mankind.
Because it's only going to happen with all of us together.
The message to Muslim nations and moderate Arabs, Pakistan also, is
we hold our beliefs every bit as strongly as they hold theirs. And now is the time to show it.
A huge lack of self-reflection about what went wrong with these systems and a projection outwards onto these bad guys. And it's all their fault and they're evil and they hate our freedoms.
Yeah.
Whereas what Sybil's getting into is actually how those bureaucracies work and function, the problems with them, the corruptions within them. But people don't, the mainstream doesn't really want to look at that. They prefer the simple narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. And I one of the things that came out when I was working on the story was the stuff that she brings out is so big. It's actually probably the biggest scandal that's ever happened in the United States, and yet it's happened under the radar with nobody really knowing about it. I mean, what, you know, we look at what's happening with Bradley Manning, which is absolutely atrocious. We look at what's happening with Julian Assange, and, you know, whatever we think of Julian Assange, you know, this is, it's not about the person, but let's look at the way in which we've seen WikiLeaks and whistleblowing being treated by the Obama administration. It's quite extraordinary. But all of the focus is on those things. But Sybil Edmonds, who is a whistleblower and presides over one of the most credible whistleblowing organizations in America, the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, and she has something like 70-odd former federal government officials who've worked in national security over the, you know, many of them are veterans who've worked across government, you know, for 10 years, 20 years. All of them basically with insane stories of what has gone on inside the US government and how they've been retaliated against. I mean, so the stuff that she's bringing out really is actually extraordinary, and to the extent that one of her FBI supervisors has actually described the scandal as bigger than Watergate.
How could it be? I mean, we went there in 1997, or was it 1998 during Clinton, and we bombed this pharmaceutical company. They had to do with Bin Laden. Well, during that period, after that period, we actually officially were meeting with Bin Laden and Bin Laden's group, which was never referred to as Al-Qaeda. It was always still Mujahideen. And to have this documented evidence that was gathered through counterintelligence operations that targeted Turkey. Now, the same thing, they had counterintelligence operation, not my division, but there was a large, and this was an official Pakistan division. And to say, and yes, this guy was wanted for these particular bombings, we bombed, but yet you have all this evidence, hard evidence. And again, it was not that some CIA faction, they let Mujahideen do that. In fact, indirectly helped. None of that. We officially, in official capacity, we were meeting with these individuals, with this group, all the way till 2001.
You mentioned this Caucasus operation and Central Asian operations. What, in your view, was the objective of these meetings, were these part of a wider operation linked to these Mujahideen networks in these countries? Was this, I mean, you mentioned the Cold War, and how that, you know, the Cold War mindset has become even more entrenched in different ways. Was this part of that?
It was, but first, like in the early part of second half of 1990s, in 1997, 1998, some of these operations involved actually bringing a lot of people, and included Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, into Turkey. They were trained, and actually, their passports were changed. They were given Turkish passports with NATO airplanes. They were taken to the operations that were being carried out. This was during all this Bosnia and Kosovo. And this was, again, official operations. It was not that, oh, these Mujahideens, they had their backpacks and they found their ways through the borders and they ended up in places like Albania. It's not. They came from Turkish, official NATO Turkish planes into certain Eastern blocs in Europe. And that's how they were brought in there.
Yeah.
So, in 1997, 1998, there was a lot of those were concentrated on bringing these people into that bloc, the Balkans. And there was some focus there with all the together operations carried out through our Chechen channel there. But then towards 1999, Azerbaijan became actually a hub that both included the stuff with heroin, but also it was organizing other smaller religious factions in other stands, in other countries like Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. And this was when Fethullah Gulen, which is his organization worth 20-some billion dollars, he's in the United States, his headquarters is in the United States, he's a Turkish, you know, religious figure, they opened more than 350 what they call madrasas. It's a different version of, it's not exactly the same madrasas the Wahhabis set up in Pakistan, but madrasas and mosques in all this country. Now, granted, in some of these countries that they were more siding with Russians, they kicked them out. They banned Gulens and all these madrasas, but many others they didn't. So when that was happening, part of these madrasas, the religious schools as part of mosques, as Gulen's movement, together with the U.S., NATO, Turkey factions were setting up in these countries, they had this very strong English language department. If you look at it, I mean, this is not top secret.
Yeah.
If you look at it, they emphasize English language. So you would see hundreds of English teachers, Americans, with diplomatic passports going to these countries to work for Gulen's madrasas, teaching English in religious schools.
Yeah.
And would you give diplomatic passports, Americans going there teaching English in madrasas? It's mind-boggling. But again, these were all done through official, implemented, formal channels. These were not, U.S. saw that some Mujahideens or some people, big people from Saudi Arabia were pouring money into this, and Turkish Gulen was doing that, and they said, you know what, this is to our advantage. Hey, this is a great thing. Be like that. That's not the case. The whole implementation planning, from the planning stage to the implementation, were all taking place here via State Department in Washington, D.C. It was fully being communicated with the Turkish arm of NATO people, whether in military attaché or other military-related organizations in the United States with offices in NATO. So this was not, again, our enemies is our friend. That was not the case. And I know it's being reflected. So if my case would have been allowed to proceed in courts, because I know the agents I worked with and I work for, in fact, during closed meetings, some of these agents, they came and they told all this to these senators. They vouched for these reports, and they would have testified under oath. Or if the Congress would have deposed them, because initially Congress was going to have public hearings on my case, all these agents from the FBI, they would have told the truth, because they were the good guys in this, the FBI agents. But it didn't happen. The hearings were shut down because Congress was gagged in my case, because the CIA, the State Department, they didn't want that. The courts were shut down, and the media, initially, during the first couple of years, some of these people, insiders, the agents from the FBI, and even from some other agencies, including DEA, they were even willing to sit anonymously. I mean, they would be known to the reporters, like New York Times, Washington Post, talk to them, but as long as their names were kept off the record, anonymously, they were cited. Not a single one of those meetings and what they gave these reporters were printed.
Yeah.
And after that, they knew you can't get this information out even if you wanted to.
Why is there this block on these issues which are so significant and critical to U.S. national security and what happened in 9/11? Why was there this strange and bizarre reluctance, and not just reluctance, but this active opposition to investigating these things, and in fact protection? What does that say about this American national security system?
Well, the seat I call is the hardest question of all. It gets so frustrating to, you know, I see, because I truly appreciate some of the 9/11 truth movement, but then it gets so frustrating to see all these different factions, and I have no idea how many of them are actually set up to be, discrediting factor in there. I mean, you get people who, it just only about a year ago, I realized what in the world was this LIHOP, MIHOP, and people coming and saying, oh, you subscribe to whatever hop, and then this is the other hop. And that's the thing, because what I try to tell people, okay, is that you take all the stuff with the gag orders and what I know, you put together, you have written on this topic. Okay, and your book also relies on heavily documented, sourced, right, information. You put together with what happened with, let's say, Colleen Rowley, okay? It's not a huge incident, you know, but you take that, put it together with Robert Wright, Agent Wright in Chicago. You get this thing that be still, it's so convoluted with the Able Danger. You bring all the stuff together, and you look and say, it has nothing to do with what we are being told about who did 9/11 and why and how we didn't know, or the fact that we didn't know. Hmm. Now, it's this thing that they're talking about, LIHOP and MIHOP and all this, I would say, confusing versions and the theories and hypotheses that they're putting forth. I think that actually ends up taking away from the macro picture, because... Yeah. To say this thing of what make it happen, then you have to look at a lot of people that had to be in it with it, okay? If you ask my personal opinion, this is not an expert opinion, I would say, no, the people like from the top layer, second or third year, they did not make anything happen, okay? Now, the top people, maybe the top layer, there are indications and so much evidence that they may have let it happen. Even afterwards, okay? We see with Yasin al-Qadri, they had, and this is not under only Turkish division, because one of the things that people don't know about Yasin al-Qadri, supposedly he escaped and he got out of the United States. The first place he went for a while was Albania. Mm-hmm. But immediately after that, he went to Turkey, okay? And a lot of his banking and operations are all placed in Turkey. Again, you're coming to this Turkey, NATO ally Turkey. Is it some ally that is backstabbing us? Absolutely not. It's the other way around. It's the other way around. Turkey is serving the orders and the wishes, and they carry out with the manual and the recipes of what they are given by their bosses, the NATO, US, UK bosses.
Yeah.
So you look at Qadri, ends up in Turkey. All these different bin Ladens and all these people from Saudi Arabia that were taken out. Did FBI agents in the counterterrorism divisions, at least the ones in Washington field office, were they fuming? Did they want to question these people? Absolutely. Who are these? Somebody says, no, you can't question these people. Hmm. And why? I mean, you can't go and say, here are these people. Then you say, no, you can't investigate these people. Then you look at all the other mysterious things. We are not capturing anyone that we can prove has any relation to 9/11. And the ones we say they are either dead or we make sure they are killed before they are out in the court. Hmm. I mean, you put all this stuff together and then say, okay, now look at this and start looking at it from this macro perspective. That is productive. That is getting us close to all these unanswered and questions about 9/11. That should lead us to a path that says, stand up, rise, and demand the further truth, but also justice based on that truth. I don't think it's going to happen. We are sitting here 40 years later, and we still don't have answers on Kennedy's assassination, for God's sake, okay? Hmm. And it's every day, and it's pessimistic, I know, but it looks more and more like this is going to be another one of those chapters in U.S. histories. When they come and they give you this official stories, and it even later throughout the years when bits and pieces of information comes out, it's either too late because people have given up, nobody listens, the media blacks it out, and it just goes nowhere. And you end up with this cult of people who say, here are all these facts. And that's what happens. We end up being this cult.
Absolutely. I mean, what I think is really powerful, though, about what you have done and the information that you're presenting is that, I mean, one, you don't get involved in all of that kind of theoretical speculation. But most importantly, what I think is interesting is that the stuff that you're talking about gives us a glimpse into a very different, almost parallel universe.
And many thanks to Dean Puckett, Sibel Edmonds and Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed for that production, with which we conclude this look at the parallel universes that lie underneath the well-managed fronts presented by the commercially controlled media. This show and all previous episodes are available for download from the Unwelcome Guests archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. If you have ideas for the show, or you hear material that you think is worthy of it, do get in touch. You can contact me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
PUC Radio.
PUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of useful consciousness.
Speak out. And a vast paranoia sweeps across the land, and America turns the attack on its twin towers into the beginning of the Third World War, the war with the Third World. And the terrorists in Washington are shipping out the young men to the killing fields again, and no one speaks. And they are rousing out all the ones with turbans, and they are flushing out all the strange immigrants, and they are shipping out all the young men to the killing fields again, and no one speaks. And when they come to round up all the great writers and poets and painters, the National Endowment of the Arts of Complacency will not speak. While all the young men will be killing all the young men in the killing fields again. So now is the time for you to speak, all you lovers of liberty, all you lovers of the pursuit of happiness, all you lovers and sleepers deep in your private dream. Now is the time for you to speak before they come for you, O silent majority.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti, in this moving appeal for peace that could have been written today, as Democrats and Republicans are calling for regime change, intervention, and war. Of course, the reference to 9/11 dates it. This poem was recorded in March 2003. It was the introduction to the TUC radio program on the Neoconservative Project for the New American Century. You may remember the circumstances. About 1 year after September 11, a blueprint for U.S. global dominance surfaced that named the countries to be invaded: Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and maybe also Iran and North Korea. The document also stated that the American people would never agree to such a military global dominance project unless there was an event that galvanized public opinion, such as a new Pearl Harbor. The document was called Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategy, Forces, and Resources for a New American Century, and it was commissioned by Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and others in the year 2000, before any of them were in government. The think tank, the Project for the New American Century, produced this blueprint. The document remained secret until 2002, when it was discovered and published by the Scottish Sunday Herald. The Project for the New American Century, or PNAC, was founded in 1997 by William Crystal and Robert Kagan. To this day, prominent leaders in the neoconservative movement. PNAC was dissolved in 2006 and replaced with a Foreign Policy Initiative, also founded by William Crystal and Robert Kagan. In spite of what many of us see as the failure of the policies he recommended, Robert Kagan was appointed as an advisor by Hillary Clinton when she became Secretary of State. Clinton also hired Kagan's wife, Victoria Nuland, as her spokesperson. Nuland had previously served as a top aide to Vice President Cheney. Victoria Nuland, by her own admission, was personally involved in the recent regime change in Ukraine. In 2014, Robert Kagan told the New York Times that he hoped that his neoconservative views would prevail in a Hillary Clinton administration. "I feel comfortable with her on foreign policy," he said. In February 2016, Kagan gave Clinton his formal endorsement for president. On the last day of the Democratic Party convention, retired Marine General John Allen delivered a frightening and jingoistic endorsement of Hillary Clinton. In one of the most troubling moments at the convention, the shouts of "No more war" from Bernie Sanders supporters were drowned out by Hillary Clinton backers, who began shouting, "USA, USA." In 2003, Ferlinghetti and friends were appalled that the media had not presented the text of the neoconservative agenda, Rebuilding America's Defenses. Now, over a decade later, that text, still relatively unknown, takes on new significance. You'll be able to tell in a moment how thoroughly the plans of 2000 were followed, and how deeply entrenched the neoconservative agenda has become as it permeates both Republican and Democratic leadership. R.G. Davis, founder of the San Francisco Meme Tube, is the reader of this important PNAC text.
You are listening to excerpts from Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategy, Forces, and Resources for a New Century, produced by the Project for the New American Century. Key findings. This report proceeds from the belief that America should seek to preserve and extend its position of global leadership by maintaining the preeminence of U.S. military forces. Today, the United States has an unprecedented strategic opportunity. It faces no immediate great power challenge, and its political and economic principles are almost universally embraced. At no time in history has the international security order been as conducive to American interests and ideals. The challenge for the coming century is to preserve and enhance this American peace. Yet unless the United States maintains sufficient military strength, this opportunity will be lost. There are four essential missions. America's global leadership and its role as the guarantor of the current great power peace relies upon the safety of the American homeland, the preservation of a favorable balance of power in Europe, the Middle East and surrounding energy-producing regions, and East Asia. Large wars. The United States must retain sufficient forces able to rapidly deploy and win multiple simultaneous large-scale wars, and also to be able to respond to unanticipated contingencies in regions where it does not maintain forward-based forces. This resembles the two-war standard that has been the basis of U.S. force planning over the past decade. Constabulary duties. Third, the Pentagon must retain forces to preserve the current peace in ways that fall short of conducting major theater campaigns. Such forces must be expanded to meet the needs of the new long-term NATO mission in the Balkans, the continuing no-fly zone and other missions in Southwest Asia, and other missions in vital regions of East Asia. Current armed forces are ill-prepared to execute these missions. As the Joint Chiefs of Staff have admitted repeatedly in congressional testimony, they lack the forces necessary to meet the two-war benchmark as expressed in the war plans of the regional commander-in-chief. Forces for major theater wars. The one constant of Pentagon force planning through the past decade has been the recognized need to retain sufficient combat forces to fight and win as rapidly and decisively as possible multiple, nearly simultaneous major theater wars. In short, anything less than a clear two-war capacity threatens to devolve into a no-war strategy. Unfortunately, Defense Department thinking about this requirement was frozen in the early 1990s. To better judge forces needed for building an American peace, the Pentagon needs to begin to calculate the force necessary to protect independently U.S. interests in Europe, East Asia, and the Gulf at all times. Forces for constabulary duties, that is, local policing actions. In addition to improving the analysis needed to quantify the requirements for major theater wars, the Pentagon also must come to grips with the real requirements for constabulary missions. The 1997 Quadrennial Defense Review rightly acknowledged that these missions, which it dubbed smaller scale contingencies or SSCs, would be the frequent and unavoidable diet for U.S. armed forces for many years to come. Quote, based on recent experience and intelligence projections, the demand for SSC operations is expected to remain high over the next 15 to 20 years, unquote. Repositioning today's force. Despite the centrality of major theater wars in conventional force planning, it has become painfully obvious that U.S. forces have other vital roles to play in building an enduring American peace. It will be difficult, if not impossible, to sustain the role of global guarantor without a substantial overseas presence. Our allies, for whom regional problems are vital security interests, will come to doubt our willingness to defend their interests if U.S. forces withdraw into a fortress America. Equally important, our World Wide Web of alliances provides the most effective and efficient means for exercising American global leadership. The benefits far outweigh the burdens. Whether established in permanent bases or on rotational deployment, the operations of U.S. and allied forces abroad provide the first line of defense of what may be described as the American security perimeter. Guarding the American security perimeter today and tomorrow will require changes in U.S. deployments and installations overseas. In the Persian Gulf region, the presence of American forces along with British and French units has become a semi-permanent fact of life. Indeed, the United States has, for decades, sought to play a more prominent role in Gulf regional security. While the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein. The American armed forces stationed abroad and on rotational deployments around the world should be considered as the first line of American defenses. These forces need to be among the most ready, with finely honed warfighting skills, and only forces configured for combat indicate the true American commitment to our allies and their security interests. But they also need to be highly versatile and mobile with a broad range of capabilities. They are the cavalry on the new American frontier. The Persian Gulf and surrounding region has witnessed a geometric increase in the presence of U.S. armed forces, peaking above 500,000 troops during Operation Desert Storm, but rarely falling below 20,000 in the intervening years. Although Saudi domestic sensibilities demand that the forces based in the kingdom nominally remain rotational forces, it has become apparent that this is now a semi-permanent mission. With the rationalization of ground-based U.S. forces in the region, the demand for carrier presence in the region can be relaxed. As recent strikes against Iraq demonstrate, the preferred weapon for punitive raids is the cruise missile, supplemented by stealthy strike aircraft and long-range Air Force strike aircraft. East Asia. Current U.S. force planning calls for the stationing of approximately 100,000 U.S. troops in Asia, but this level reflects Pentagon inertia and the legacy of the Cold War more than serious thinking about current strategic requirements or defense needs. The prospect is that East Asia will become an increasingly important region marked by the rise of Chinese power. It is not too early to recognize that the presence of American forces in Korea serves a larger and longer-range strategic purpose. For the present, any reduction in capabilities of the current U.S. garrison on the peninsula should be unwise. If anything, there is a need to bolster them, especially with respect to their ability to defend against missile attacks and to limit the effects of North Korea's massive artillery capability. A similar rationale argues in favor of retaining substantial forces in Japan. In recent years, the stationing of large forces in Okinawa has become increasingly controversial in Japanese domestic politics. And while efforts to accommodate local sensibilities are warranted, it is essential to retain the capabilities U.S. forces in Okinawa represent. In Southeast Asia, American forces are too sparse to address rising security requirements. Since its withdrawal from the Philippines in 1992, the United States has not had a significant permanent military presence in Southeast Asia. Finally, The Southeast Asia region has long been an area of great interest to China, which clearly seeks to regain influence in the region. In recent years, China has gradually increased its presence and operations in the region. Raising U.S. military strength in East Asia is the key to coping with the rise of China to great power status. In Northeast Asia, the United States must maintain and tighten its ties with the Republic of Korea and Japan. In Southeast Asia, only the United States can reach out to regional powers like Australia, Indonesia, and Malaysia, and others. This will be a difficult task requiring sensitivity to diverse national sentiments. In sum, it is time to increase the presence of American forces in Southeast Asia. The United States should seek to establish a network of deployment bases, or forward operating bases, to increase the reach of current and future forces. Not only will such an approach improve the ability to project force to outlying regions, it will help circumvent the political, practical, and financial constraints on expanding the network of American bases overseas. Deployment bases. Currently, U.S. Southern Command, the Pentagon's regional command for Latin America, is moving to implement a plan for forward operating locations to make up for the loss of Howard Air Force Base in the wake of the U.S. withdrawal from Panama and the return of the Canal Zone. Indeed, sustaining effective counter-drug operations will be difficult after the loss of Howard until arrangements for the new locations are in place. To achieve full coverage of the region for counter-drug operations, the command plans to utilize airfields ranging from Puerto Rico to Ecuador. While it should be a clear U.S. policy that such bases are intended as a supplement to the current overseas base structure, they could also be seen as a precursor to an expanded structure. This might be attractive to skittish allies, as in the Persian Gulf region, where a similar system is in operation, for whom close ties with America provokes domestic political controversy. Air Force, toward a global first strike force. From the Gulf War to Operation Allied Force over Kosovo, the increasing sophistication of American air power with its stealth aircraft, precision-guided munitions, all-weather and all-hours capabilities, and the professionalism of pilots, planners, and support crews has allowed the Air Force to boast legitimately of its global reach, global power. On short notice, Air Force aircraft can attack virtually any target on Earth with great accuracy and virtual impunity. American air power has become a metaphor for, as well as the literal manifestation of, American military preeminence. One of the many tasks for the future is that the Air Force reevaluate the need for greater numbers of long-range systems. In some regions, the ability to operate from tactical airfields is increasingly problematic, and in others, notably East Asia, the theater is simply so vast that even tactical in-theater operations will require long-range capabilities. In sum, the Air Force is too small, especially its fleet of support aircraft, and poorly positioned to conduct sustained operations for maintaining American military preeminence. The Air Force needs to be restructured, repositioned, revitalized, and enlarged to assure continued global reach, global power. In particular, the Air Force should be redeployed to reflect the shifts in international politics. Independent expeditionary air wings containing a broad mix of aircraft should be based in Italy, southeastern Europe, central and perhaps eastern Turkey, the Persian Gulf, and Southeast Asia. But it is in East Asia that the Air Force must look to increase its capabilities and reach. The Air Force needs roughly to double its forces stationed in East Asia, preferably dispersing its bases in the south, as it has in the north, perhaps by stationing a wing in Philippines and Australia. As in Europe, Air Force operations in East Asia would be greatly enhanced by the ability to sustain long-range bomber operations out of Australia. New course for the Navy. The end of the Cold War leaves the U.S. Navy in a position of unchallenged supremacy on the high seas, a dominance surpassing that even of the British Navy in the 19th and early parts of the 20th century. With the remains of the Soviet fleet now largely rusting in port, the open oceans are America's, and the lines of communication open from the coasts of the United States to Europe, the Persian Gulf, and East Asia. Yet this very success calls the need for the current force structure into question. Further, the advance of precision strike technology may mean that naval force combatants, and especially the large deck aircraft carriers that are the Navy's capital ships, may not survive in the high technology wars of the coming decades. To meet the strategic need for naval power today, the Navy should be realigned and reconfigured along these lines. The Navy needs to reflect the gradual shift in the focus of American strategic concerns towards East Asia. A majority of the U.S. fleet, including two-thirds of all carrier battle groups, should be concentrated in the Pacific. Marine Corps, back to the future. For the better part of a century, the United States has maintained the largest complement of naval infantry in any nation. The U.S. Marine Corps, with a three-division structure mandated by law and with a strength of more than 170,000, is larger than all but a few land armies in the world. Its close relationship with the Navy, to say nothing of its own highly sophisticated Air Force, gives the Corps extraordinary mobility and combat power. This versatility, combined with a punishing deployment schedule, makes the Marine Corps a valuable tool for maintaining American global influence and military preeminence. Yet, while this large Marine Corps is uniquely valuable to a world power like the United States, it must be understood that the Corps fills but a niche in the overall capabilities needed for American military preeminence. The Corps lacks the sophisticated and sustainable land power capabilities of the Army, the high-performance precision strike capabilities of the Air Force, and, absent its partnership with the Navy, lacks firepower. Restoring the health of the Marine Corps will require purchases of badly needed new equipment and restoring the strength of the Corps to something near 200,000 Marines. In particular, the Marine Corps, like the Navy, must turn its focus on the requirements for operations in East Asia, including Southeast Asia. In many ways, this will be a back to the future for the mission of the Corps. To maintain its unique and valuable role, the Marine Corps should be expanded to permit the forward basing of 2nd Marine Expeditionary Units, MEUs, in East Asia. These MEUs should be based in Southeast Asia along with a repositioned Navy carrier battle group as described above.
You heard excerpts from a document by the Project for the New American Century. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
You know, throughout modern history, people have observed that one of the ways that an oppressor group, whether it's Europeans coming to the Americas or whatever, one of the ways they maintain control is through control of the mind of the oppressed. It's what we, as you point out, we often refer to as internalized oppression, where you start to believe the story of the people who have dominated you.
That's the voice of author and educator Dr. Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Jensen about his latest book, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. So stay tuned.
And we're very privileged this evening to be joined by Dr. Robert Jensen. He is the author of Arguing for Our Lives. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Sylvia.
Wonderful. Now, we live in a world today where, you know, public discourse has become a tool used to create stories that direct us in a world where we're told, you know, capitalism is the only way to organize our society, for instance, the war can be just and that invasions are righteous. And so there's a lot of things that unless we are really aware of, you know, how is it that that story is being framed? How is it that that story is being informed? We feel lost. We're deliberately being misguided. Can we talk a little bit about the need for us to not only be able to be curious about our world, but how do we come to that small T truths that connect the dots and help us make a story that makes sense to us, that is in alignment with who we are?
Well, I think your use of the word story is important because when we think of the news of the day, the events in the world that are important, we should always remember that there's a bigger story behind it. Take one of the examples you used, capitalism. Whatever the story of the day, whatever the news story of the day, whether it's interest rates going up or the budget or taxes or whatever it might be, there's a bigger story behind it. And one of the key elements of that story in the modern world, in the West, in the developed world especially, but essentially everywhere, is that capitalism is a sort of natural state of being. Well, you know, a simple inquiry reveals pretty quickly that's not true. Capitalism is a product of history. It's a product of choices made really over the last two or three centuries. It's not a natural state of affairs. But if you can tell this bigger story always that capitalism is natural, then there's no way to critique it, and the news stories of the day have to be dealt with within that capitalist frame. So always going back and asking, what are these bigger stories being told? You mentioned war and the whole idea of just war. If you look at the contemporary Middle East, where a lot of the stories about conflict are emanating right now, the question of Syria, the idea of bringing peace and stability and justice to Syria is not easy. Let's not be naive about this. But the assumption behind a lot of the news stories is that the West, led by the United States primarily, but including the European nations, even Canada, the assumption is that we make the decisions about what level of violence to use to bring that peace and stability and justice to Syria. There's a sort of larger story about the inherent moral superiority of the West and the right of, therefore, the West to make those decisions. That's the big story we have to contest. So the news of the day is important, but the bigger stories are even, I think, in some ways more important.
When I was thinking about what it means for me to be able to understand the story behind the story, you know. I often think about, you know, the colonial wound that we all have been born into and that we never speak about. Because if you're in university or if you're in school, sometimes you hear things like, we're in a post-colonial era. And it sounds romantic to think that it's post, that, you know, it's not the same. So what kind of questions should we be asking us when we take this idea that imperialism was something of the past, that colonial power is something of the past, and that we've now transcended or somehow evolved out of that wound of racial?
Yeah, that's a great point, because, of course, the notion of colonialism, you know, the mainly out of Europe, let's say, the colonial powers literally taking control of other parts of the world, especially in the Americas, let's say the New World. Well, that condition has, of course, changed, and we are post-colonial in some sense. So the countries once ruled by Spain in South America are no longer ruled by Spain. The countries in Africa once ruled by the British or the French or the Germans or the Dutch are no longer ruled by those countries. So in that sense, of course, we are post-colonial. But there's a couple of really important questions you're raising. One is, of course, colonialism was used to describe the direct control, political control, by those European states over the other lands. But although that has changed, the economic relationships are largely unchanged, so that the economies or the former colonial world are still very much controlled out of the West, out of Europe, the United States, for instance. So the question of imperialism is not just about, you know, what kind of direct rule a colonial state might use, but it's how the effective sovereignty of a people is controlled, and that can be done economically as well. I think there's an even deeper way in which we've not transcended the colonial mindset, as you put it. One is, remember, when Europeans came, let's just talk about Canada and the United States, North America. When Europeans came, one of the arguments to justify European colonialism was that the land was not being used, that indigenous people, because they weren't exploiting the land in the same way that Europeans understood that, meant that the land was, in a sense, empty. Of course, there were people here, the indigenous people were here, but because they weren't exploiting the resources in the same way Europeans thought they should be, they, in a sense, had no claim. And that colonial mindset about how to exploit the land, the water, and the air, that's still very much with us. In fact, the entire world is basically based at this point on that conception of exploitation of what we typically call nature. In that sense, we're still locked into the colonial mindset no matter where we live. That's an important reminder, I think, of what we're up against and how things can change on the surface and underlying dynamics still can be very much in place.
As you were speaking, I was thinking about the way power becomes axiomatic. You know, it justifies itself, right? It becomes self-justifying. So in the case of Latin America, if you're growing up indigenous, you know, it is assumed that your own destiny to be brought into slavery, you know, reflects your inability, your inferiority to the colonizers, right? And so it becomes this this privilege that builds upon itself, and over time, the wound becomes internalized. So rather than seeing the history of, you know, rapacity and the violence, you know, that took place of genocides and the struggles, all we see is ourselves as the reason for our own demise, for our own wounds, for our own poverty. There is this story that unfolds, and it becomes retold and told. And over time, you know, no one even remembers where the story began. We just know that poor people are poor because they're lazy, or, you know, that's the story that sounds palatable, yeah, to people who want to justify the system of privilege as it exists. So what would you say to those who have been wounded by too many repetitions of that same story of repression and oppression? How do we break out of it?
Yeah, well, that's a great point. And, you know, throughout modern history, people have observed that one of the ways that an oppressor group, whether it's Europeans coming to the Americas or whatever, one of the ways they maintain control is through control of the mind of the oppressed. It's what we, as you point out, we often refer to as internalized oppression, where you start to believe the story of the people who have dominated you. If you think of, you know, some of the key political social movements of the middle of the 20th century, you know, what we call in the U.S. usually the 60s, this was a central feature. So think about the black liberation struggle in the United States and the assertion that black is beautiful. Well, that was a very real and concrete reminder to people of African descent that white beauty standards were not the only way to understand yourself. And so that black is beautiful for many people literally meant looking in the mirror and remembering that you are beautiful. It may sound trivial in some sense, but it was an important recognition along with more traditional political slogans and policies. Of course, with indigenous people in the United States, and again, I typically speak mostly about the U.S. experience, not knowing Canada as well, but the American Indian movement in the United States was not just a political movement, you know, arguing for certain kinds of policies. It was a reclaiming of indigenous traditions. In fact, people referred to themselves as traditionals, those who would no longer accept the idea that Indians should become white to achieve their, you know, greatest potential. And that was very much a part of that struggle as well. You can even think about it in feminist terms, that a lot of feminism was helping women understand that men's definition of them was not the only way to understand themselves. So, you know, this is part of the struggle of every movement that tries to challenge what you pointed out is the naturalizing of domination. And by that, I simply mean the fact that every group of people that's ever tried to dominate another group has tried to make that seem natural, as you pointed out. And fighting that kind of seems obvious once you say it, but it's amazing how that naturalizing of domination, as you're pointing out, can kind of weave itself into the way we think about the world, whether we're on top or on the bottom of that particular dynamic.
You know, I was reading in your book and you write, we are most free when we are most bound to others. Can you talk a little bit about what this means for you and this idea that the struggle out of this colonized mind, this internalized oppression, it's entangled, it's intertwined with all of us.
Yeah. Well, that's probably one of the most important realizations I think we can come to in the modern world that's defined especially by a capitalist notion of what it means to be a person. And that's another important point, that, you know, behind every political philosophy, every political movement, there's a sense of what it means to be a person, what it means to be human. And in contemporary America, defined by corporate capitalism and mass consumption, you know, people are thought of as being individuals, discrete and completely independent. And in that conception, you know, you are part of a group, part of a society, only to the degree you choose to do it. Your identity is as an individual. Well, that's a very idiosyncratic way of thinking about being human, very modern. For most of human history, people really didn't think of themselves primarily as individuals, but as part of groups. Your identity came from your place, going back to hunting and gathering societies, your place in a band-level society, you know, society that probably had no more than 50 to 150 people in it. Well, that's dramatically different than this individualism, this obsession with the individual we have in the modern world. So when I wrote, we have to realize we are most free when we are most bound to others, it's a challenge to that notion that freedom is in independence, in your separation from others. No human being's life makes any sense separate. We aren't separate. We are social beings, and we get a lot of our sense of ourselves from the surroundings, from not only our social group, but also our place in the larger natural world. And so freedom doesn't come when you're detached from people. Freedom comes from, in my point of view, from understanding your relationship, again, not only to other people, but to that larger living world. And for me personally, who, you know, someone who grew up with that very intense sense of individualism, it was a real struggle to recognize that the key is to human life isn't independence. It's a recognition of interdependence with others and with what we tend to call nature.
I was thinking about, you know, this interconnectedness and this this desire to be in community and how painful exile can be. And I wonder if you could talk, because you've written extensively on, you know, the way the violence against women has also become naturalized. And so for me, the question is also, how do we create spaces that are both bounded, but at the same time recognize the inherent value of each person, the uniqueness and beauty that each brings to the whole. And the reason I ask you this question is because as a woman, you are raised to care for everybody. You are raised to be, the caregiver, and so there's a lot of oppression that has been naturalized, and that I feel this sentence taken by itself could be taken to naturalize that process. You know, women are the birthers of, life, and so they should do all the housework and they should care for all the children. And so it becomes this naturalized story that's the culture. That's our culture. We're people who do everything as a group, and so that's the role of the women. How do you speak to your female students who see this call to be bonded and at the same time want to create some spaces where possibilities can emerge for women?
Right. Well, let's go back, because I think these two questions are related. First, to that notion about recognizing our interdependence doesn't mean we're all, clones of each other, that we're somehow just kind of robots and identical. One feminist philosopher I'm fond of many years ago wrote an essay where she talked about the struggle for individuality without individualism. And by that, she meant the kind of honoring of individual differences that you're talking about, because of course we all are distinct and different, and we all bring different kind of qualities to the common life. And so we don't want to erase individuality. We don't want to erase individual variation among human beings. It would be a pretty boring world if we did that. It's this obsession with individualism, this assertion that we are first and foremost separate, that we're trying to challenge, not the idea that people are different. Obviously, people are different, and that's a good thing. So this struggle, I think, is encapsulated very nicely in this phrase, the search for individuality without individualism. The way that plays out in gender, it's an interesting story that patriarchy tells, especially versions of patriarchy, I think, that are rooted in religious ideas. Because if you look at that argument that comes from more traditional religious sectors, they claim that both men and women, both husband and wife in the traditional family that they always value, both of them have obligations, right? The man is the head of the household, and he has obligations to provide, to lead, to guide, and the woman has different obligations to care for the household and all sorts of things. And first of all, we recognize that because there is that individuality, that you can't typecast people so easily. You can't say all men fit this role and all women fit that role, because there's individual variation. It really is rather stifling when you have no choice in the way that you live your life like that. But the other thing is, of course, if you put men in that role and say they have obligations, but you give them all the power to decide, well, the obligations are not going to play out equally, as you're pointing out. And men are naturally, I think, when given that kind of power, going to gravitate toward the misuse of that power, just as any group of human beings given a kind of, unnatural power over others in this sense is likely to abuse it. So what we learn is that, from this example, I think what we learn is that, being human is difficult. It's a struggle. We are individual, yet we are part of a group. We want to fit into roles in a society that help make society stable, but those roles can be stifling, so there's got to be flexibility and creativity in them. I mean, all of this is just a reminder that, being human and having the big brain and having the capacity that we're exhibiting right here, the ability to, have a conversation that's linguistically complex and intellectually complex, that's all very exciting. It also makes life hard sometimes, and that's what we have to struggle with. But the answer is in the struggle, not in pretending this is all very simple, as traditional religion, for instance, wants to do.
Thank you so much for being with us. We've unfortunately run down the clock. We are speaking with Dr. Robert Jensen. His book, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thanks, Sylvia. Always great to talk.
Thank you.
I'm going to finish out today's show with Drop of Water by Dana Lyons. For more music by Dana Lyons, go to cowswithguns.com. Bye for now.
There's a drop of water on the wall, and the drop's about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle's flowing down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream. Busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground, and in my heart, the chains falling apart, the wildness in my soul, and for once in life, for once in life, I know I'm not alone. For the mountains make our bones, with the oceans in our blood, our feet planted, planted firmly in the mud. We are alive, the burning embers in our eyes, the tingling touch upon our skin. And in the heat of passion, we begin to understand that we are of this land, that we are part of Earth, and when it's threatened, we will fight for all we're worth. We watch the dam come crashing down, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free. Drops about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle's flowing down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground, and in my heart, the chains falling apart, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free.